The core of Skull and Bones is 15 or 20 families. These are old line families. They came to the United States from England about the 1600s, 1700s. And you've got the Lords and the Wadsworths and the Bushes.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 5th of February 2021. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news once more is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Number crunching in part two, intensive care beds and excess deaths. Let's just have a look at the actual numbers. So many rumours flying about. Also, Pemberley Care Home in Basingstoke. One story that's not been put on the national news that maybe should have done. A third of the residents, 22 elderly people, die after the vaccine is introduced into their care home. But this is not the right story, is it? But it's important nevertheless. And also a $15 billion profit for Pfizer. That's profit, not turnover. $15 billion based on their new mRNA vaccine. Their hedge funds are very happy. But what about those that are getting the jabs? And what about the MHRA, the regulator, the mesh scandal from 2019 that led to their chairman being sacked for incompetence? And some ambulance staff in Wales are refusing the vaccine. Another wrong story. You'll hear a lot of this stuff on the local news, but it never makes it onto the nationals because, as I say, it's the wrong story. With paramedics refusing the vaccine, I've not heard about that, have you? And some hippie stuff, spiritual or political. What is going on with Dr. Rashid Buttar from the United States? On a more serious note, the assassination of Brandy Vaughan in the she's an anti-lockdown or was campaigner in the USA. I say assassination because this is a political killing, surely. Her death is being looked at by the police, but it looks extremely suspicious. We hear from her tonight talking about before she was murdered, probably murdered anyway, as to all the break-ins to her home and things being moved around, psychological warfare being used against her in her own home. That meant she had to move out to a different town. That's Brandy Vaughan, who died in November. An extreme weather in Bristol 400 years ago. This is obviously a question for those into climate change, and it's our old friend Dr. Evan Jones from the Cabot Project at Bristol University that's brought this out this week. And he was the guy we spoke to about the Merchant Venturers, about them being the same families that funded and organised the trip of John Cabot back in 1497 that discovered North America. Obviously, there were people there already. You discovered it first, but that's how it's put in our terms from here. Also, the US accused Russia of microwaving their diplomats. Now, hang on. I thought that that's what we did to them. And a US visitor to the UK, Anne Sikulis, who drove into and killed the moped rider Harry Dunn while she was driving on the wrong side of the road, RAF Croughton. She then fled to the US under diplomatic immunity, but it now turns out she was actually directly employed by US intelligence, not just an innocent army wife. An anonymous accusation of anti-Semitism trying to get my book, The Siege of Heaven, taken offline. Similar wording, in fact, almost identical to that used in January 29 by UK Lawyers for Israel, created and funded by the Israeli state in order to try and get this program taken off of FM, the Ofcom complaint, which we won. Of course, subsequently, BCFM's manager Pat Hart did that for UK Lawyers for Israel by voluntarily taking us off the air without an Ofcom complaint. And Ofcom, whilst on the subject of them, they've cancelled their licence for China's CNTV, the English language channel. But it's actually quite difficult reading their press statement as to why they've done it. To understand that, Martin Summers has been on RT talking about this story this week. And the death of Sir Brian Urquhart, the intelligence officer for Operation Market Garden, which my book, my book about Martin Bormann, which is the traitors of Arnhem, talks about. He then went on to become Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations. He's died this week. Let's hear what he had to say about himself from his own lips about Operation Market Garden, which was so important at the end of the war, extending the end of the war, and allowing the Nazis to squirrel away their wealth all around the world to then be used after by some very unscrupulous people in the British establishment and American establishment and the mafia. And the JFK assassination, Chicago mob hitman, ex-82nd Airborne Division, James Files, talks about his contacts in the CIA for the JFK assassination. You can hear a lot more of my longer interviews, the one we haven't had time to broadcast, throughout the rest of the week on the PRSC stream here. Do please record these streams if you can, because we sometimes have technical trouble making and uploading recordings. As last week, Radio for All was down for nearly 2 days over the weekend, just after I'd uploaded this show. Also, my three books published in 3 weeks over the Halloween lockdown, The Traitors of Arnhem, about Bormann, I was just talking about, and also a compilation of my articles, The Siege of Heaven and The Siege of Heaven Reader, a series of post-medieval extracts about strategies to take over power secretly. And I send free versions of these out with my weekly email. You can buy them all via www.bilderberg.org or on the Martin Bormann Timeline tab at our show site, thisweek.org.uk. So you get the free downloads for a watermark copy, or you can even buy them if you fancy a proper ebook. But first, some of this week's COVID developments. Martin, actually, we're not talking about COVID developments in the first part. We're going to be talking about more normal politics, and we hear this morning that local elections will be taking place. Crikey, that's great, isn't it? I remember getting a bit of a shiver down my spine last March in 2020 when we were told there won't be any elections. Because everyone was starting to gear up for them at this time last year. So they will be taking place on Thursday, the 6th of May. You have to go and take your own pen in order to mark your ballot paper. The front runners here in Bristol for the Lib Dems is going to be Dr. Caroline Gooch, who's a pharmacist for obvious reasons. The Lib Dems are pushing their expertise in COVID there, really. And for the Greens, the same candidate as last year, Sandy Hoare-Ruthven, who's from the Creative Youth Network, and also identical for Marvin Rees for Labour. He's the incumbent mayor, although he's had a year without being elected. He's the former BBC journalist and NHS mental health manager. So, Martin, what do you make about this whole thing of they finally decided they are going to have elections this year? Do you think it's safe to do so?
I think so. I mean, nobody was really sure what was going to happen last year. It was all, everything was up in the air. Nobody quite understood what was happening, but you can't not have elections indefinitely. And of course, we saw in the US, the elections took place, but of course there was lots of postal voting and a controversy surrounding that and so on. And of course, one of the main problems is there isn't going to be much canvassing. So, you know, the normal elections where you go around and knock on the doors and try and work out who your supporters are, I think that's going to be very difficult to do.
Well, we talked about this with Tim Kent last week, didn't we? I mean, surely you can actually speak to people at the door, so long as you're reasonably distant from them.
You can, and of course, what's actually happening is a lot of canvassing is now done on telephones and social media. And, you know, I mean, I quite enjoy the whole thing of knocking on doors and so on. You know, it's got its own attractions. But you can see people in many ways it's being overtaken by technology anyway.
Don't people treat you a bit like Jehovah's Witnesses?
They do. I mean, some people don't want to talk to you, and, you know, that can be a bit disconcerting. But on the other hand, certainly as a Labour canvasser, it's a real opportunity to sort of communicate with your core voters. And, you know, you get a real sense by talking to people of how people's moods are moving, you know. And it's actually, you know, it can be a bit of a schlep, but if the weather's nice, it can be quite fun.
Now, one little revelation about Marvin Rees, the incumbent mayor, is although, of course, he's standing for the Labour Party, when he was at the BBC, he twice refused to join the union. I mean, you do wonder, maybe, Martin, whether he's that is the NUJ. You do wonder whether he's, you know, a little bit too far to the right, because people, I mean, certainly when I was at the BBC, people that didn't want to join the union were actively against it, were sort of sending a signal to the management that they were actively not going to participate in what is effectively one of the sort of core Labour activities of in a trade union.
Well, you'd have to ask Marvin himself what his position is on that. I've no idea what his thinking was. I mean, basically, in terms of where he fits in the spectrum in the Labour Party, I'd say he's dead central. You know, basically, he's probably quite happy with Starmer as the leader, as are Thangam Debonair and other Labour MPs in Bristol. So, you know, he's pretty much in the same sort of camp as they are.
I mean, he has said he doesn't really like party politics, hasn't he? Which is a way of saying that he, you know, he wants to be friends with everybody.
Well, I mean, don't forget, when he first got elected, he inherited from George Ferguson an all-party cabinet, which was unique in Britain. I mean, nowhere else had anything like that. And for a while, he tried to make that work. But he eventually, you know, reverted. I mean, that's not going on anywhere else. And, of course, he's now reverted to the same setup that you've got in most of the other major cities, with a Labour mayor and a Labour administration.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're going to be refreshing all the councillors. And also, I think we're not, I don't think it's the Metro Mayor. I think it's just the, well, it may be the Metro Mayor as well, mightn't it? It's certainly the Police and Crime Commissioner. But we've got this weird situation in many of our large conurbations like Bristol now, where you've got these kind of Venn diagram of two different mayors, a sort of inner mayor and an outer mayor, where the Conservatives decided that they would introduce Metro mayors along with the Lib Dems in order to make, and because the cause of the cities was so pro-Labour, that they, if they expanded the area to right around the city, they could have a constituency which was much more likely to vote Conservative. And that's, of course, what's happened here in Bristol. We've got a Conservative Metro mayor and a Labour mayor. But in the city centre itself, Martin, which is what we concern ourselves with most of the time, you know, the policy, the planning, the developments and things like that going on in the city, the way our money's spent, you know, whether we can get through the city or not, you know, the public transport, things like that, are actually public transport, I think, is dealt with by the Metro mayor. But most of these concerns are to do with the mayor, and the mayor has got a lot of power. Who do you think are the, I mean, I've picked out those three parties as I think are the front runners, the Greens, Labour and the Lib Dems. But you, as a Labour person, would you agree with those three as the main front runners for the mayor election?
I think that's pretty, you've got a transfer vote for the mayor. So it's possible for people to vote for their first preference and then vote for their second preference. That means, I would suggest, that the Tories have got no hope whatever. They won't get elected for sure. It's possible that the Greens could do well. I think they might. But if they, I doubt whether they will have enough to defeat the Labour voters in the end. And a lot of Green voters will put their second preferences to Labour anyway.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking. It's quite a lot of Lib Dem and Greens, actually, may well be putting their second preference to the Labour voters,
I suspect. But Green voters will put Labour as their second preference, most likely.
It really is going to be interesting to see how it all pans out, because this will be, as it was, you know, previously when Marvin Rees was first elected from Labour, it was really, it's the sort of Jeremy Corbyn surge that led to that. So this is, I think, it's going to be quite a lot of people voting based on how they think Starmer's doing nationally, whether they really, you know, go for the long term and the national picture of the Labour brand.
Well, Bristol West is probably one of the highest green target seats in the country at a general election. And in the mayoral election, those who are unsatisfied with Starmer's turn to the right in the Labour Party can vote green with a Labour second preference, with no danger whatsoever of letting in the Tories. So I would expect for the Greens to do pretty well. They might even do enough to win. But I doubt it, because there's limits to their appeal. You know, they've already got quite a number of councillors in some parts of the city. But, you know, the Labour vote has stood up pretty strongly at recent elections in Bristol. And the Labour Party in Bristol West is one of the biggest memberships in the country. So I think it'll be very, very surprising if Marvin isn't re-elected.
I know you're a big fan of proportional representation. If we were to have that, I mean, we've got a form of it in the mayoral election, but obviously not with the individual councillors. So do you think it would look different if we did have PR in Bristol, you know, total PR?
It would probably, yes. I mean, because there is a one transfer in the mayoral vote, that then means that people can vote more. You know, there'll be more variation in that. But of course, it's often very much a bit of pot luck who wins any particular ward, because you've just got to get the most votes. And if there's two other parties that are in contention, you can be elected with less than a third of the vote. And of course, that ultimately, to my mind, is a silly way to do it.
Just generally on the Labour Party, we had a little clip from him last week, Paul Embury. He's written this book, Despised, Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class. And I know you don't really agree with his analysis, Martin, but he has got some stuff to say on the lockdowns, which we'll hear in part two. We had an enormous number of people joining Labour, didn't we, under Jeremy Corbyn. A lot of them are now drifting away, disillusioned. Do you think that Labour can literally here in Bristol as part of the mayoral elections can survive that? Because this is obviously to actually have a good membership base, people who are prepared like you to go out on the streets, maybe deliver leaflets, you know, knock on doors, even if it is with a broom handle or something, and speak to people in the streets. Otherwise, it really is only the local press and the media who are going to, you know, spin what the various candidates are saying, and they are in the driving seat rather than face to face. People will be getting their information about who to vote for via the mass media.
Well, as you say, some people have resigned from the Labour Party, so the mass membership that we had is some people have left. But on the other hand, we've still got quite a lot of members, and the problem with under a first past the post setup, they haven't really got anywhere else to go. Although I think what will happen when we get a general election, whenever that is that the contest in Bristol West in particular will be between Green and Labour. And it's possible that the Greens could take it. But nevertheless, it's going to be quite, I mean, and even if they did, that would just be another Green MP to join,
yes,
Caroline Lucas.
The only one. Okay, so what do you think Labour needs to do in order to make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, I mean, I'm not very impressed with Keir Starmer's this leaked report that he's going to wrap himself in the Union Jack, and for example, all of these things we've been talking about, giving the secret services and the military carte blanche to break the law, all the opposition parties, the Greens, the SNP, Plaid Cymru, all voted against that, and the Corbynite left all voted against that. No problem voting against allowing the military and the secret services to break the law. But Starmer wants the Labour Party the parliamentary party to abstain, and they have abstained. I think that's going to cause a lot of anger in the grassroots of the Labour Party, and therefore, you know, that's good news for the Greens, particularly round here.
Well, anyway, look, talking about people getting all their information, or a lot more of it, that's according to Tim Kent last week, through the media rather than actually speaking face-to-face with candidates here in Bristol, as we all get sort of quite excited about the elections actually happening this year, thank God. The BBC reps fear a new format will dumb down local radio news. Oh, great. That used to be my job many moons ago, 30 years ago. Journalists fear that new BBC-imposed format for local radio will mean hard and investigative news is played down in favour of light, fluffy stories, entertainment and trivia. The National Union of Journalists' representatives from local radio stations across England said the new format will result in less robust political reporting, holding those in power to account. News reporters will be allocated additional duties, including music scheduling, creating entertainment-based features and creating non-news material. So you train someone to be a journalist, a reporter, and then you say, oh, go and schedule the music. NUJ National Broadcasting Officer Paul Seeger said local radio news is about connecting with local communities, about reflecting their lives, producing warm-hearted human interest stories. But it's also about holding politicians, businesses, health trusts and schools to account. Our reps in local news believe the new format will downplay serious news, deeply concerned. The BBC, Martin, almost seems to be committing suicide here in many ways. I mean, things like the political programme Question Time is a bit of a joke, with very important questions simply not being put to many of the participants, with the Fiona Bruce from the Antiques Roadshow being the chair of a serious political programme. You'd be forgiven for thinking the BBC really are trying to throw themselves off a cliff here.
Well, as you say, we had a journalist, ex-BBC journalist, did we not, on the show some months ago, pointing out that the local bulletins that they do, like Points West, they actually increase their... lots of people watch those bulletins more than watch the national news. And that just shows how important that local reporting can be if you take it seriously. But of course, the BBC itself, I was talking about Ofcom on RT yesterday, the BBC itself is being lined up to be destroyed by Paul Dacre as head of Ofcom and various, you know, Tory place people who are being put in charge of it. And they're hoping to just get rid of the licence fee, to minimise the possibilities of the BBC challenging the government. And they've, of course, they want to give them a licence to Murdoch to have an equivalent of Fox News. So all that stuff about the Leveson inquiry, about Murdoch not being a suitable person, that's all going to go by the board. And, of course, you know, the Dominic Cummings-type faction in the Tory party are determined to change the news environment so that their particular hobby horses are given more of a run at, as they are in the mainstream Tory press. And they're trying to basically shut down anybody else who's got a different point of view.
Certainly lots of censorship. Martin, do you want to just tell us a little bit about the English language Chinese channel? I can remember when I got interviewed to go on there a few years ago, over to Beijing with a nice, would have been a well-paid job. And they asked me, they said, oh, well, have you watched our Chinese English language TV channel? And what, you know, and I said, yes, I have. I watched, you know, for 15 minutes or something. And what did you think? I said, it was like watching paint dry. But even watching paint dry is not apparently going to be allowed anymore. So what is going on? You know, obviously RT is a different kettle of fish entirely. They're a much more of a sort of traditional Western style of media. The Chinese, though, are very, CNTV is very controlled. It's not really, you know, it doesn't seem like the it seems to me the journalists seem almost brain dead on there. They're just kind of reading out a script. They don't kind of question stuff. They're not taught to question stuff. I've met Chinese journalists as well face to face through the union, and I found them like they didn't seem like journalists at all to me. They weren't questioning types. They were just obedient little robots, basically, that I met. So why is it that even such a robotic channel as the Chinese news, Martin, has been taken out by Ofcom?
Well, Ofcom claimed that this is not political. They usually do. Like then they took Press TV off the satellite some years ago.
The Iranian English language channel, which I'm on from time to time, which I think is you see some fascinating stuff on there, but it's banned too in the UK.
Yeah, well, as you know, anybody can watch this stuff online anyway. So being banned from the satellite doesn't mean that you can't watch it. But of course, it means if you're on the satellite, it means that people can flick, you know, people with their remotes can just flick onto you by accident, and you might be able to influence them. And I think they banned Press TV because it gave an image of Iran which was very different from the kind of enemy image which they're given in mainstream Western media. Like, you know, in other words, they didn't have two heads and they talked quite sensibly about various things. And that was why they were got rid of. I think the Chinese TV has been got rid of because they said it was to do with not being independent of the Chinese government. And it's, well, you know, is is Murdoch's empire independent of Murdoch? The answer is no, it's not.
Is the BBC independent of the British government?
Well,
no.
To some extent it is, and to some extent it isn't.
Well, they appoint all the, they make very political appointments and financial appointments, by the way, top people from the City of London to run the BBC, who are their chums, the Tories.
Yes. Well, of course, then it's talked about that Paul Dacre is going to take over as the head of Ofcom. And, of course, Paul Dacre is an extreme Tory, former editor of the Daily Mail, and he's going to be the referee, apparently. And, of course, at one stage, after the Leveson inquiry, there was going to be some kind of reform of the print media in this country, but that's all gone by the board. I think it's just political. I mean, the fact is that we are, you know, we've got our aircraft carrier in the South China Sea. That's very much in the interest of the Red Wall voters, as we know, because they want Brexit done. And that's why we need to send the aircraft carrier to China. And part of all of this is we don't want the Chinese answering back. So we don't want people be able to tune in and find out
what the Chinese think about stuff.
So let's get rid of them.
The main point there is that this is a US policy and not a British policy, really, that we're just implementing this to do this as a favour for the Americans. We've had a whole spat, haven't we, of US and Chinese journalists being expelled last year. This is really, it seems to me, Ofcom doing the Pentagon's bidding for them.
Yes, I mean, I would argue that boring as it is, it's probably a public service for ordinary people in Britain to be able to find out what the Chinese government are thinking, rather than having it spun for them by the BBC or Murdoch or whoever else.
So we're not allowed to watch China.
The problem they've got is because they, as you say, because they've got such a controlled setup, they don't actually communicate very well their own position. But you might as well let them. I mean, to my mind, what harm does it do to let them say their stuff? You don't have to agree with it. And what would be useful would be if they did interesting stuff about what goes on in China, you know, positive stories about what goes on in China.
Yes, they do. And the Iranian channel does exactly that sort of thing. It gives you real insight, cultural insight. I mean, we've got whatever it is, 250, 300 channels, mostly kind of shopping channels and God knows what. And they're multiplying
the
and the actual information that might prevent a world war is being shut down one by one. And also, I would remind everybody that during World War II, the British government took the decision not to jam German broadcasts. So Lord Haw-Haw, broadcasting from Radio Luxembourg, who was a British traitor, he was allowed to broadcast, and there was no attempt to jam it because they realised if we do this, this is going to make it look as if we're trying to stop people hearing this stuff. What they decided to do, which was a far better decision, and I'd love to see the same sort of thing now, is to encourage programs, comedians and satirical programs to lampoon the other side. If you think what they're doing is silly, then don't just try and block what's being said. Just have a bit of a go at them, a pop at them, take the mickey out of them. It's a far better way of doing things, I think, and a much more mature and democratic way than just trying to stifle information and facts.
Yeah, well, I mean, Al Jazeera has not been banned, even though it's run by the government of Qatar, who nobody elected, nobody elects them. And they've got very, very close links to jihadi forces around the Middle East, but they've got their programs are worth looking at. I think that you do need some regulation. I would argue that the Chinese should be allowed to have a station in Britain, but that Murdoch shouldn't. But there you go. That's just me.
Well, the Australians should, surely. And I mean, I think, you know, but basically you should have both a bit of private and a bit of, you know, I think, Martin, you and I agree as socialists, we don't both believe that you shouldn't be allowed as a private person to have something which attempts to compete with the national. But just seems to me, particularly with the BBC, that there is a real sabotage attempt on it at the moment, as I illustrated with that story from the Morning Star about BBC local radio being nobbled and Points West being nobbled. These are the things that people want to watch, and yet they have to be destroyed in order to make way for, like, as you say, people like Murdoch, as CCTV or the Chinese station and probably soon RT as well have to be nobbled so that we get our full dose of Orwellian propaganda. But look, Martin, I know you love talking about Brexit and trying to bring every story back to it. But this time you're gonna be successful, because in Northern Ireland we've seen amazing scenes this week of loyalist terrorists marching what looked like, to me, I'm not sure if I'm correct, but out of a police barracks. I don't know what they were doing in there, or at least marching past it in Northern Ireland, Martin, making threats against people who are working at the border across the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and Britain. So before we hear your comments on it, Martin, this did come up at Prime Minister's questions this week. The questions, I think it was from Ian Paisley, son of the famous Ian Paisley from the 20th century and the Troubles. So Prime Minister's questions from the on the Northern Irish border.
Ian Paisley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Prime Minister, you say that your commitment to Northern Ireland is unshakable. Well, I speak for all of my constituents today when I tell you that the protocol has betrayed us and has made us feel like foreigners in our own country. Tea and sympathy will not cut the mustard. So what is the Prime Minister actually going to do when you realise, when the Prime Minister realises that the EU will do nothing to help Northern Ireland? Will the Prime Minister use all of the instruments at his disposal? Will he use, if necessary, his parliamentary majority? Will he legislate, if necessary, to remove the impediments to trade in Northern Ireland? And will he be a man of his word and allow businessmen in my constituency to bin the unnecessary documentation that he told us we could bin? Prime Minister, be the unionist we need you to be.
I utterly share the frustration of the honourable gentleman about the way the EU, in particular, the EU Commission, temporarily seemed to call for you to use the protocol in such a way as to impose a border contrary to the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement, contrary to the letter of the Good Friday Agreement. And we will do everything we need to do, Mr. Speaker, whether legislatively or indeed by invoking Article 16 of the protocol, Mr. Speaker, to ensure that there is no barrier down the Irish Sea. And the honourable gentleman's business constituents, some of whom I know very well and admire very much, can continue to do business unfettered between Northern Ireland and the rest of this country.
Well, I don't think that's going to be the last we hear about Article 16, Martin, is it? Do you want to just explain what's gone on here? Because this was basically unfolding just after we closed on Friday night last week, this programme, where there was been a row all week about vaccines, where the EU saying they weren't getting enough of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Obviously, theirs is the Pfizer vaccine. That's a German company. And the border was very briefly, or at least there were soundings that they were going to actually impose controls between North and Southern Ireland. Anyway, do you want to just explain what's been going on here?
Well, I mean, the vaccine row, it was suggested by the EU because they're getting annoyed with AstraZeneca. They think they've been cheated by AstraZeneca. And they were saying that, you know, we want to keep our vaccines for us. You know, whatever motivation there was, but they withdrew it pretty quickly. I mean, they hadn't even talked to the Irish government about it, and the Irish government were obviously saying, well, what are you talking about? We've just had these huge, humongously tortuous negotiations to keep a border in, make sure there's no border, and then you come along and say, well, why can't we just impose it about the vaccines? And whoever made that suggestion has been told to shut up, and of course it's created a firestorm. But the fundamental problem is still there, which is that if we had stayed in the single market or the customs union, then there wouldn't need to be any border at all. But the Tory right wing, the European Research Group, wanted a Brexit that would allow us to do trade deals in theory with other countries. That means we can't stay in the single market or the customs union. That means that there has to be a border, and therefore that border has to be in the Irish Sea.
Okay, so you're saying
nothing that anybody can do about it. That's what has to happen.
What you're saying, we should have stayed in the single market, which was drawn up by Rudi Dekker at Philips Electronics back in the 1980s in Eindhoven, and that would have meant we would have been still under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice.
Well, of course, one of the pillars of the Good Friday Agreement is that people in Northern Ireland can appeal to the European Court of Justice. That was one of the things that made it attractive to the Republican nationalist side.
Yeah, but the EU have backtracked immediately, pretty much, didn't they? So they've been left with a bit of...
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolutely idiotic thing for the EU to do. They hadn't even consulted with the Irish government. So the Irish government were absolutely flabbergasted when they came out with it. And then whoever had come up with the idea was just told to shut up. It's not actually clear whose idea it was. But, I mean, nobody in Ireland or in Britain was prepared to put up with it. And they were just told, what are you talking about? But, of course, what it did do is it focused the loyalist opposition to the border in the Irish Sea, became more vociferous as a result. But, of course, in the six counties of Northern Ireland, the majority voted to remain in the EU. They just did. And the loyalists who are making a fuss are the minority, even in Northern Ireland. So never mind anywhere else. So they can huff and they can puff. And of course, Boris is there saying, yes, I'm going to, basically he just lies automatically saying we're going to get rid of this border. And I don't see how he can do that without repudiating the entire agreement, which means that we then move to trade war with the EU. And that really will need a border. And of course, that's not going to happen. And of course, it's all the other borders. There's lots of small businesses are now discovering there's a massive amount of bureaucracy involved in leaving the single market and the customs union, and lots of businesses are going to fail, not just in Northern Ireland, but all across Britain. And that was an inevitable part of the deal that the Tories decided they wanted to do. That's where we are.
Well, the graffiti said all border post staff are targets, and this is popping up in various places around Northern Ireland, Martin. No Irish Sea border. Shankill says no to Irish Sea border. What are they going to do? They're going to try and build a bridge like Putin did to Crimea.
Well, I think what will happen with this is it's not clear that the mainstream loyalist paramilitaries are involved in this. The guys that were marching around with the balaclavas.
What are we talking about here? Hang on, because you know this area pretty well. UVF, UFF, Ulster Freedom Fighters, who are we talking about?
I'm just saying, but the Police Service of Northern Ireland have said, we don't think that the mainstream loyalist paramilitaries are involved in these threats. There are people making threats, but they're not being made by the mainstream loyalist paramilitaries. The guys who were marching around in the balaclavas, that's actually to do with an internal feud within the UVF, I think. So that's a separate matter. And of course, what will happen if they threaten the border staff, they are going to have a situation where the border will be closed. So the border they don't want in the Irish Sea, the people trying to cross that border and get their paperwork processed, they won't be able to process their paperwork. So the border will be closed. Now, when the IRA were attacking the border posts in South Armagh and so on in the past, they're trying to wreck the Northern Irish economy to drive the British out. But the loyalists, if they go down the road of trying to threaten the border staff, all they will do is mean that nobody will be able to trade across the Irish Sea. And they really will have to buy their sausages from the Republic.
We hear in the BBC back in December, Martin, we've got 12,500 loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland. These are basically private armies, aren't they?
Well, apart from the fact that they were armed, trained and directed by the British military for many years, they're not that private. I mean, the point is that they were part of the peace process as well. And in actual fact, it's 20 years since the Good Friday Agreement, and lots of younger loyalists, quite clearly a lot of unionists, voted to remain in the EU and are quite happy with a sort of halfway house setup.
Okay, so they say
that could have continued if the English right wing had decided that they could live with the single market.
7,500 in the UVF and 5,000 in the UDA. Is there any real difference between the Ulster Volunteer Force and the Ulster Defence Association?
Yes, there is. The Ulster Volunteer Force is actually older. The Ulster Defence Association was founded later. And it's a bit like the same sort of differences you've got on the Republican side between the official IRA, the real IRA, we've now got the real IRA, the Irish National Liberation Army, the Provos. I mean, they're all on the same kind of wavelength, but they're not necessarily the same structure. And they often, in the past, have had feuds and conflicts, both between those two organisations and between individuals within them. I'm reasonably optimistic about this. Because of the history of the situation, people are very well aware what the limits are of political grandstanding. everybody's got an extreme point of view. There's lots of extreme views. People are used to that. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to go back to a load of killing. But of course, what will happen over time is that the Northern Irish economy will become more and more integrated with the Republic's economy and with the European economy, because they're going to be still in the single market.
Well, I mean, especially
with the rest of the Britain.
Especially the politics, as the Catholics don't use their contraceptives and they carry on making loads and loads of kids. The politics is going to shift, and it is shifting, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's a general demographic shift going on. But I think the whole point of I spoke to Gary McMichael, who was the head of the UDA at the time, and David Irving, who was the head of the UVF at the time, in London at a conference. And they said, well, we accept that we are going to be the minority at some point. And when that day comes, we want to have the same kind of veto over being forced into a united Ireland, which the Republicans have tried to assert over us. And therefore, even with the demographic change, there will some special arrangements will have to be made for Northern Ireland. And that's why the Loyalist paramilitary signed up for the deal. And I think what's good about the Good Friday Agreement is the hardliners on both sides looked into their flinty souls and decided that they'd had enough of it. And I don't think a younger generation are going to come along and destroy it. There's still going to be lots of rowing. Rowing is just inbuilt into the situation. And in actual fact, although people in Britain tend to think of these people as they're stuck in the past and all the rest of it. In actual fact, both sides are quite politically sophisticated. They're actually, you know, for example, they understand different electoral systems in a way that people in England don't. And they've got a much more realistic understanding of what can and can't be achieved. They don't grandstand. The possibility of peace
isn't necessarily going to be here, about what were the Troubles really all about. And it does seem to me, looking back on it, particularly when the Bilderberg chairman and the guy from Arnhem, were we talking about Arnhem in the second part, what you've got there is him being defence secretary when the Troubles started, and it was obviously a provocation with the paratroopers being ordered that it was okay to shoot into civilians. Maybe they'd been told that they were armed when they weren't. Anyway, it was a provocation, and it does look to me as if, you know, this was a deliberately sparked by the British establishment in order to be an excellent urban warfare training ground for several years. Am I wrong to be so cynical about the Troubles?
No, you're not. I mean, there were elements within the British Army who thought that all they had to do was flex their muscles, and then they would crush the IRA like cockroaches, and peace would be restored. And of course, what happened on Bloody Sunday, that wasn't just accidental. They planned to go out and shoot a load of people in order to put the fear of God into the nationalist community. That came out of the IRA actually bugged the paratroops headquarters, and they gave the tapes to the Savile Inquiry, and where it was quite clear that they didn't. It wasn't just accidental, they did it deliberately. Now, at the same time, of course, the biggest biggest atrocity in the Troubles was the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, carried out by the Glenane gang and using explosives supplied by MI5. The Garda Síochána are very well aware of that. Most people in England aren't aware of that at all. They think the IRA blew things up and killed people, but the Loyalists blew things up and killed people. The Loyalists were being directed by the British Army's Force Research Unit, headed by Brigadier Gordon Kerr. None of these people have been punished. And, of course, they went on, in my view, and your view too, to coordinate a lot of the so-called Islamist terrorism, which we've seen subsequently, that is being run from inside the same infrastructure.
It was put across, you know, in the 1980s and 90s, etc., as a religious conflict between Protestant and Catholic, but it was much more to it than that. There were two completely different cultures there, two completely different societies that were separated, and it was almost as if it was an exercise also in forcing people to take one side or another.
Well, I mean, there's been a mountain of people writing and discussing what the ultimate causes are. I mean, the two communities live very, very close to each other, and they've got a great deal in common. I mean, that's, this is what was interesting when I, it was years ago when I went to this conference at the TUC in London, and the UVF and the UVA were there, but so was the then Sinn Féin mayor of Belfast, whose name escapes me now, I'll have to remember it. But the point is that they were able to communicate with each other, and there is, you know, there's actually quite a lot of political sophistication there underlying all of the hostility and all the rest of it. And in fact, they've got more common sense about this stuff than many the sort of right-wing people in England who want to invade Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, and they haven't got a clue what they're talking about.
It's like a kind of divide.
They're going to destroy Libya and then go home for a cup of tea, you know.
Yeah, it's like an exercise in modern-day divide and rule, but of course there are so many casualties.
It's not just modern-day. The divide and rule is the British government basically put the Protestants in there when they and the plantations in the 1640s and then again in the 1690s in order to keep the Irish down. It was a deliberate strategy.
They gave them all the good
that's,
land.
That's why they're there.
All the good land went to the Protestants, didn't it?
That's right. And of course, these historic injustices tend to carry on and to carry on poisoning the well. As we know in Palestine, I mean, the French settlers in Algeria lived there for 120 years and there were millions of them, but they were outnumbered and eventually they had to up sticks and go back to France. The Israelis have only been in Israel since 1948.
At which point?
So they could all have to up sticks and disappear.
I think
these things just don't go away. I mean, history has a habit of, you know, coming back to bite you in the bum, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think at which point I've got to plug that Pontecorvo film, the brilliant director Pontecorvo's film, Battle of Algiers. If listeners have never seen that, it's really a fantastic portrayal of the way that the Algerian population fought back against that French occupation. So let's get on to slightly more localized matters and something which is a particularly burning, horrific injustice, really, which is the legacy of Grenfell, which has been being discussed quite a lot this week, Martin, where we've got a massive tower block in Bristol city centre of luxury flats, which was built about 7 or 8 years ago, which had some of this cladding on, which has got a massive superstructure of scaffolding all around it where this cladding is being all replaced, yet we've also got some of this flammable cladding apparently on Bristol City Council's blocks of flats which were refurbished a few years ago, which is not being replaced. This is a burning injustice here, isn't it? That, you know, the idea is that you're basically sitting in another Grenfell Tower and there's nothing, we as landlords at Bristol City Council, we're not going to do anything about it. Sorry.
Well, I'm not quite sure what the situation. I mean, I believe we have had people on who were councillors on the show saying that the council didn't have cladding, but I may be wrong about that.
Okay. Well, anyway, look, let's look at the bigger picture nationally, and this is obviously something which we're going to have to go into in a bit more depth in the future to get, you know, some hard evidence on this. The council doesn't want to talk about it. And that's maybe because it would be very expensive and they're just saying to the government quietly behind the scenes in a diplomatic way, give us the money and we'll sort it out. But the government won't give them the money. The replacement for the cladding wasn't something that the government guaranteed. There was a pot of money and councils around the country had to come running, and it was like first come, first served, and it only took a few seconds for the money to run out. So that isn't a very satisfactory way of dealing with the fire. It's almost as if the government wants it to happen all over again, because it's not going to allow people to live safely in their homes. And so anyway, let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions this week again, where Keir Starmer, a Labour Party leader, he had a go at Boris about, quite rightly, about what's happened to leaseholders. This is people that own their flats, or at least lease them. Their flats are now, some of them, are worth nothing because of this flammable cladding that's still sitting there.
Mr. Speaker, whatever the Prime Minister claims being done isn't working. Because this is the situation. Through no fault of their own, huge numbers of people, especially leaseholders, are stuck in the middle. They are living in unsafe homes. They can't sell, and they're being asked to foot the bill. That's the situation that they are in. Take, for example, Will Martin. He's a doctor who's got a flat in Sheffield. He's been spending his days on the front line fighting COVID in the NHS. He spends his nights worrying about the £52,000 bill that he now has to pay for fire safety repairs. He doesn't want future promises, Prime Minister. He doesn't want to hear that it's all been sorted when he knows that it hasn't. He wants to know, here and now, will he or will he not have to pay that £52,000 bill?
Mr. Speaker, we're determined that no leaseholder should have to pay for the unaffordable cost of fixing safety defects that they didn't cause under no fault of their own. And that's why, in addition to the £1.6 billion we're putting in to remove the ACM and the UPL cladding, we are also setting up and have set up a £1 billion building safety fund, which has already processed over almost 3,000 claims. And I sympathise very much with the gentleman Dr. Martin, that he mentions, and I hope very much that his particular case can be addressed in the course of the forthcoming package that will be produced by my right honourable friends.
Kirsten.
There are thousands and thousands of people in exactly the same position. I spoke to leaseholders caught in the middle of this on Monday. One of them was Hayley. She's already gone bankrupt, Mr. Prime Minister. She's 27. She bought a flat, she's lost it, she's now bankrupt. It's too late for her. Those leaseholders that I spoke to had three very simple asks. This is what they want: immediate upfront funding for unsafe blocks, a deadline of next year to make buildings safe, and protection for leaseholders. We put those forward for a vote on Monday. The Prime Minister says he's determined to do something about it. What did he do? He ordered his MPs to abstain. If the Prime Minister is serious about moving this forward and ending this injustice, will he commit today to those simple asks from leaseholders?
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, we're getting on with the job of helping leaseholders across the country by remediating their buildings. And in addition to the funds I've already mentioned, I can tell him that we're also introducing a £30 million fund to install alarms and other interim measures. And we're making it very clear to the mortgage industry that they should be supporting people living in such accommodation, and that the and making clear to all sectors of the industry that people living in such homes should not be tied up in the whole EWS1 process, and that will benefit about 450,000 homeowners, Mr. Speaker. I think he's right to raise the problem, but we're getting on with addressing it, Mr. Speaker. And we're getting on with addressing the fundamental problem that afflicts this country, and that is the COVID pandemic. And that's why I'm pleased that we've now done 10 million vaccines, first vaccinations across the country. And I repeat, Mr. Speaker, had we listened to the right honourable gentleman, we would be stuck at go, because he's shaking his head, but he can check the record. Several times he said that this country should remain in the European Medicines Agency. And if he wishes to on a point of order, to correct me, because he said it was wrong just now, I think he should study the record and he'll find that is exactly what he did. We want to get this country safe again. We want schools to come back, Mr. Speaker. He continues to refuse to say that schools aren't safe, Mr. Speaker. And on the contrary, he spends his time looking at Labour focus groups who tell him that he should stop sitting on the fence.
Prime Minister, just in fairness, I think we've got to be somewhere near the question that was asked. And I don't want you to go around the world answering every problem and issue. There's a lot more questions. Who's going to allow you to do that?
I think it's Leslie Hoyle, the Speaker, isn't it? He really did just let Boris go completely off topic for about a minute at the end there, finally saying, well, that's enough, you've gone off topic. But, he just lets him ramble on and on and on. And, of course, Boris knows that because it's the final question that Keir Starmer asked there, that Keir Starmer won't have a chance to come back. So he's actually, being very sneaky with his abuse of the chair and his abuse of his position as Prime Minister in that particular bit of Prime Minister's questions. But Martin, what about the main point there? Let's just ignore Boris's going off on a tangent for a minute, but what the main point about he doesn't sound comfortable, Boris, at all with this. He's saying, oh well, I'm going to ask the mortgage companies to be sympathetic. That's just not going to happen, and it's not enough. This is a sop.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we've discovered during the COVID pandemic is that in actual fact, there's not just one magic money tree. there's a whole forest of magic money trees, and I think that the Tories would be quite. What they ought to do is just say, whatever it costs, we will fix it. The same with the school meals in the holidays.
No, it's not just that, is it? This, Martin,
and they say we haven't got enough money.
Martin,
and they go, yeah, that's back.
Create a fantastic boost to it. It'd be like almost like Roosevelt's New Deal. You know, there'd be loads and loads and loads of work to be had, and it would be a way of getting the economy going. Actually, none of this building work is considered non-essential. People can go to building sites. So where I'm in St Paul's here in Bristol, there's building workers here on every site every day, packed, and that's no reason why they can't just get on and do that right away. And this seems to me to be an obvious thing to do if the government has actually cares about. But I suppose it's also thinking, isn't it, well, most of these people in these tower blocks are Labour voters, so we don't care if they burn.
Well, I mean, I think some people are in the council housing, yes, they might be likely to be Labour voters, but a lot of the others, perhaps, no, they might be swing voters. It would be there's a lot of agreement there between Starmer and Boris, or if we can call him that instead of Defef or whatever, that something's got to be done about this. What's actually happening is that, as I understand it, the opposition gets Mondays, they get to have a discussion of something they want to have a discussion about. And there's a general order has come out to Tory MPs that they are not to vote on any of these Labour motions. Now, in actual fact, some of them did vote with the Labour motion the other week. I can't remember what it was about. So occasionally you do get some rebels who will vote, but most of them, they don't want to get involved with voting down anything that the Labour Party proposes. So that's why they all abstain. Again, it's an abusive procedure. I mean, you know, the more our system goes on, we can see, you know, all of the fallout from Brexit, COVID, and everything is that the system itself is basically out of the arc. You know, it's like a crappy old
thank
boiler.
Thank God we've got the Great Reset coming along.
Not been fixed for years. You know,
Martin. Thank God we've got the Great Reset coming along. Maybe that will sort it all out, will it?
Well, the Great Reset is a global phenomenon. But I mean, the British constitutional setup is being tested to destruction here.
Yeah, but the city is also globalist, you know, globalised. The money system is a global system, and that's really at the root of most of these problems, surely.
The British state, which created the British Empire, has always been a fundamentally reactionary structure, which is why the Irish broke out of the British Empire in 1920, the first country to do it. And when Collins went to negotiate with Churchill and Lloyd George, they said, listen, we're minded to give you independence, Michael. But what about India?
Hang on, Martin, we're talking about the financial architecture of the world
I'm
now.
I'm talking about the British Empire, of which the British Empire
is long gone.
It's an American version of the British Empire. That's why the British state, which created the British Empire, Ireland was the first country out, and what Churchill said to what Collins said to Churchill was, that's your problem. The British Empire is still being enforced in Helmand province, in Basra. The local people overwhelmingly didn't want the British army there. Well, they drove them out.
Martin,
Helmand province, the British army has been defeated three times in Helmand province.
I hate to burst your bubble. That's the American Empire, not the British Empire.
Well, the American Empire is the follow-on to the British Empire. And, of course, the British state, which created the British Empire and America, is now reached the end of its natural life. Yeah, it's going to break up. There's going to be a breakup of the United Kingdom and probably massive changes in the electoral system. Let's hope it's as peaceful as it can be. But it's not necessarily a bad thing.
OK, well, anyway,
it's time
back
to go.
Back to Bristol City Council and the flammable cladding on our tower blocks. Allegedly, anyway. I mean, I think this is something that I could almost be nice to do an experiment and chop a bit of cladding out and see if it will catch fire or not. That seems to me to be the only way to figure this out. So the council are keeping mum about it. There's a new satirical weekly blog by somebody calling himself the Central Scrutiniser on the Mayor Marvin Rees's weekly fireside chats with his old chum and our ex-boss at Bristol Community FM, Pat Hart. And it's written by a former listener of ours on FM. So you can keep track of some of these issues on that blog. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It's called Hold Authority to Account, and it's also called, and it's written by someone who calls himself the Central Scrutinizer, or herself. Anyway, just staying on the UK politics, Martin, we're getting closer to April, where these big official denials from the palace that the Queen is going to retire just make me think that is going to happen. I mean, you know, this whole saying that never believe anything until it's officially denied, because, if it wasn't true, I would imagine they wouldn't bother denying it. But if this does happen, I know you think maybe it won't, but anyway, let's just hang that on a peg for a minute. Who do you think is most likely to take over, William or Prince Charles, if this happens as the Queen reaches 95 and a Prince Regent takes over in April?
Well, as you say, it's not clear that she is going to retire. And, of course, the rules say of our unwritten constitution that the heir to the throne takes over. And until we've got a written constitution, those procedures will have to be followed. He could decide to abdicate, but he doesn't show any, as far as I can see, he's not showing any indication that he's going to do that. So if she retires or dies, then he's going to become the king.
Well, the one question is, it will mean a big change in the sort of the role of the head of state, won't it, if Charles does take over, because he certainly has been very political over the years. He's extremely open about his views about all sorts of things, although he does sue the Daily Mail every time they publish something from his. He's got his kind of harmony list of close associates that is a secret list. He puts out his little thoughts to them every week, and then they publish something like that, he gets sued. But anyway, so he is actually much more political than we're used to if he does take over, Martin, isn't he, as head of state?
Well, I mean, in theory, the monarch is supposed to be apolitical. That's what the theory is. But if you actually look at the history, you know, Queen Victoria had definite views about who she thought should be the prime minister. Not surprisingly, she was a conservative. And she liked Mr. Disraeli because he made her Empress of India. And she didn't like Mr. Gladstone because he was in favour of extending the vote to poor people and, you know, various social reforms of which she disapproved. But, you know, so the idea that the monarch has always been apolitical is simply wrong. And of course, Prince Charles has got his views. We all know what they are. You know, some of them are reactionary. Some of them could be classified as progressive. But in actual fact, what the system's supposed to be. And of course, you've got other monarchies in the rest of Europe, in Norway, for example, then it doesn't really matter what their views are because they can't enforce them. That at least is supposed to be the setup.
Anyway, some real good news this week. And that is the release of Tom Hayes. Do you remember him? Rain Man. Who hopes to rebuild his life and family after the traumatic time he spent in custody. City trader who was jailed for LIBOR rigging has been freed after 5 years. Now, I can't almost believe it's 5 years. His dad, Nick Hayes, used to be a producer for World in Action, and we had an interview with him, if people remember, on BCFM when we were on FM before the manager, Pat Hart, removed us last March. And that is something which I'm, you know, finding it almost impossible, believe it or not, to get any reply whatsoever from the board of BCFM, because I'm asking for the decision to be reviewed. And Jerry Cowhig, who's the chair of BCFM's board, has not yet replied after 6 weeks and refuses to pick up the phone when I phone him, although he always used to in the past. Suddenly he's saying nothing. It's almost as if he's had some legal advice to say nothing to this Gosling man. But then that's not his job as chair. He should be considering potentially anyway, at least reviewing the decision to take me off the air. But anyway, back in those times, Martin, this was an incredible decision to get Tom Hayes. And it did seem to me, and I'm not sure about you, but it seemed to me at the time that this guy was a totally a scapegoat because he didn't seem to want to join in with the cocaine parties, the prostitutes and that sort of thing. He had quite a nice girlfriend of his own, thank you very much. But he was quite good at rigging LIBOR. I also remember him saying absolutely clearly that as part of his job at UBS, the Swiss bank, he was given a manual. This is what part of your job is, and this is how you fix the LIBOR rate. So basically, he was doing what he's been instructed to do by his managers who got off scot-free.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's good news that he's out of prison. He definitely was a scapegoat. no doubt about it. And of course, various small fry have been thrown to the wolves here, whereas the big beasts that were really responsible have gone free. I watched the film The Great Short this week, which is about the 2008 crisis.
The Big Short, is it?
The Big Short, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's basically a drama documentary, and very, very informative. Basically, the whole system was corrupt, and the top people should have been sent to prison.
What do you mean was?
Had all their assets impounded.
What do you mean was? It's even worse now, surely.
It is, yeah, because once you bail them out, they actually become invulnerable. So what should have happened is, if you're going to bail them out, you've got to send them to prison. And if you're not going to send them to prison, you mustn't bail them out. But by bailing them out and not sending them to prison, we've now got a far bigger government intervention in the markets because of what happened in September in 2019, where the interbank market rate went up overnight to 10%, which is very similar to what happened in 2008. But in 2008, there was a complete breakdown and they had to go to the government and say, you're going to have to bail us out. But of course, what they've got now is they've already got a fund to bail out the market. So without telling anybody what they were doing, BlackRock and the Federal Reserve started bailing out the international financial system. They didn't bother to go and tell Trump what was happening. They didn't bother to go and tell Congress what was happening. And of course, then COVID came along and suddenly everybody knows that we're bailing the markets out. We may be going into negative interest rates, I see this morning in this country. This is a full decade and more after the 2008 crisis. And we still haven't got anywhere back to normal. And we're chucking money down the drain to keep the financial services sector going. And that's all, most people are vaguely aware about that, but they think it's to do with COVID. It's not to do with COVID. They had to do that anyway. And if COVID hadn't come along, we'd all be screaming, what the hell's going on here? Why are you bailing the banks out again? But we are bailing the banks out, but everybody thinks that's
well,
to do with
yeah.
COVID.
I mean, COVID is covering a multitude of sins. I thought it'd be good to look at the Morning Star. This, I think, is a terrific newspaper. Loads of stuff covered in depth in there, which you just don't see at all on the television. You might get a few articles in other newspapers about it, but very little in the broadcast press. So it's almost an essential, it seems to me. I recommend people support it if they possibly can. The Morning Star, it's not extremist left-wing, but it does do some really great stories. It's just a few from the last couple of days. It's one great story, actually, about the Indian farmers, explaining what's going on there. We've got this, tens of thousands of farmers camped outside Delhi who are trying to basically protect their future. No. International agriculture, international finance, and Mr. Narendra Modi and his Israeli and London and Zionist friends, etc., are trying their best to destroy that country and to turn it the farmers into peasants, so they have to then probably go and work for nothing in a factory somewhere. So no wonder they're angry. A really good article that goes into that. Then, Martin, anger as an academy trust pulls the plug on a local Doncaster school. And I thought I'd let you say something about that, because this whole academy system is an unbelievable joke. What happens is the school runs out of money and it just says, sorry, we're closed. And they shut their doors and all the kids are left with nowhere to go. Now, at the moment, this seems to be almost, the perfect thing for many of the people that want to keep all the schools closed. Well, actually, there are schools that are just having to close anyway because they're running out of money. So the kids are not going to get any proper education.
Well, I mean, the free schools and the academy system have completely gutted any kind of planned approach to provide provision of public education. I mean, my father was a head teacher of secondary for many years, and what they've done is they've created a pseudo market, which means that, you know, you've got some schools where they're packing them into porter cabins, and other schools where the money goes with the kids. When they first brought this in the 80s, my father tried to argue that, okay, we'll treat each school as a separate cost unit, but you can either go to the popular school with 35 in the class or the unpopular school with 15. But they said, no, the money's got to go with the children. And that means that some schools become successful, oversubscribed, and other schools have to fail. This is one of the things about competition. Somebody has to fail. And of course, at that point, if you're trapped in one of those failing schools, that's your possibility of improving your life gone. And of course, that's why we didn't used to run it like that. All schools in a local authority area were run by the local education authority. Now we've got a dog's breakfast. We used to have selection at 11 on the basis of the 11 plus, and that was ultimately got rid of because once it became based on an intelligence test, lots of middle class kids failed it and they were sent to the wrong schools.
So whatever happened to the Butler Report, Martin, and the whole idea of creating these grammar schools for bright, poor kids to give them as good an education as these public schools kids get?
Well, what got rid of the 11 plus in the end was that if you're going to have, I mean, one of the things that they did is they had this bullshit idea that girls and boys develop at different rates, because when they had intelligence tests, because previously, of course, they'd been tested on the schoolwork, and middle class kids tended to do quite good well on the schoolwork. It's just their basic intelligence wasn't that high. Some kids are being awkward and difficult can be quite intelligent. And of course, girls always pass the 11 plus they, at every stage of the system. Even now, girls do better than boys. And of course, if you're going to have a meritocratic based system, you should have actually had grammar schools with more girls than boys in them. But of course, that wasn't acceptable. So certain girls who were cleverer than certain boys were sent to secondary moderns. And of course, the other thing about having intelligence based 11 plus, which I had to do it twice because I did it when I was 10. So they made me redo it. Is that middle-class parents, lawyers, doctors, teachers, were having their kids sent to secondary moderns to learn how to fix cars and how to go and work in factories. And at that point, the system, eventually, we created a general comprehensive system where you can move through the system to any position.
I mean, depending on your merit. This system now seems to be a complete joke. Doncaster Academy, one is to get a £6 million facelift. The other one is just going to be shut. Astrea Academy Trust says it is closing Hillside Academy in Denneby, Maine, with pupils moving to neighbouring schools. Well, this is just the idea of a market for schools just seems absolutely ridiculous to me. And it's really good to see the Morning Star looking into that. Great little article. Activists are calling on Keir Starmer, though, Martin, to give evidence to the spy cops inquiry. Now, I'm sure you remember this. This is where you've got police special demonstration squad officers undercover hacking the lives of activists and campaigners, many of whom had not even broken the law and weren't intending to break the law. This is really a kind of Stasi-like political police. And Keir Starmer is being asked to give evidence because he is one of the people who, as Director of Public Prosecutions, helped to cover up this scandal.
Yes, I think it's quite interesting because Starmer sells himself as this human rights lawyer and that he's defended trade unionists and others. And he has got some track record of doing that sort of thing. But also, he's very much an establishment insider. He's on the Council on Foreign Relations, for example. And he's been briefed by MI5 and all the rest of it. And of course,
it's important to point out Trilateral Commission, Keir Starmer. This is one down from the Bilderbergs. This is a David Rockefeller Foundation creation from the 1970s, designed to be just one bit bigger than the Bilderberg, with throwing a bigger net out, for example, getting the Japanese and people like that involved. But it really is. It's an elitist, top-down organisation. Doesn't sound very Labour Party to me.
Yeah, well, the right wing of the Labour Party have always been in bed with the establishment. And Keir Starmer sees his electability as being related to the fact that he is an establishment figure. Now, of course, that doesn't necessarily cut any ice with potential swing voters to the Greens in Bristol West. But you can see, you know, some people think that that's the way to go. And of course, they've had this internal report leaked where he's being encouraged by external consultants to wrap himself in the Union Jack and so forth. And of course, we mentioned earlier that the main Labour MPs in Bristol have all abstained on the question of whether the military and the secret services should be able to break the law. I mean, I would have thought that's a no-brainer. Why is anybody allowed to break the law? If there's a law, if you can break it, then it ain't a law. But you can see where they're going with this. And of course, what may happen before the next election is we end up going to war with Iran, and we'll have to see which way he jumps then, won't
anyway,
we?
Look, the Guardian,
and of course, if he jumps the wrong way, he's really going to mess it up with the Labour grassroots.
Martin, the Guardian's reporting, and this is, you know, the left wing's paper is rolling the undercover policing scandal dates back to an episode where 20 activists were unjustly convicted of plotting in 2009 to occupy the Ratcliffe-on-Sour power station. Prosecutors were forced to abandon the prosecution of another six activists in January 2011. This is as this whole scandal was unfolding. After it was revealed, the campaigners had been infiltrated by undercover officer Mark Kennedy, who spied on left-wing activists for 7 years. I feel a little bit sorry for Mark Kennedy, actually, because obviously the activists hate him and also the police hate him as well now. For telling about the role that he did. The initial convictions were also overturned by judges who ruled that crucial evidence gathered by Kennedy had been unfairly concealed from the trial. Starmer then commissioned a retired judge to conduct an inquiry, agreeing, his allies said, that its remit with the Independent Police Complaints Commission. The judge, Sir Christopher Rose, blamed a junior regional prosecutor while also concluding that other prosecutors and police were responsible for failures over many months. So what Starmer was doing there, at least this is what the campaigners are alleging, is making sure that the people responsible for the undercover policing scandal were never brought into any court cases and managed to get off scot-free.
I mean, the inquiry is the Shrewsbury people that were convicted in 1972, these were trade unionists. They're having a court case about that coming up, and it turns out that MI5 was involved in what we're seeing here is the police state in Britain, which has always been there. People say we're turning into a police state. Say it's always been a police state. People just don't realise. The police have been behind. I mean, when we sat in meetings over many decades thinking we're being infiltrated and people are trying to manipulate the situation, we were right. They were, no doubt about it.
Well, when he was Director of Public Prosecution, Starmer made sure that all of the investigations stayed on that particular case and that the senior people were not prosecuted. I'll put a link up to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk because it really is an absolutely horrendous abuse of power. Police hacking people's lives, having children with people who've not committed any offences. These people responsible for this, rather than, you know, the whistleblower police themselves, are the ones that really need to go to jail, in my view. So the campaigners also list a series of unanswered questions, including whether Starmer actually helped bury evidence of a whole load of other miscarriages of justice caused by undercover officers, which was put to him and then dismissed.
Well, the whole thing of having an inquiry, maybe you don't need an inquiry. What you should do, as you should have done with the banks, it was really criminal prosecutions of people in MI5, of people in the police. People, if you've basically given somebody a baby under false circumstances, I would regard that, you know, there is laws against this. If you did it in private life, you'd be prosecuted. Why are we having an inquiry? We should be having prosecutions. The same with Grenfell Fire we were talking about earlier. Maybe we shouldn't have had an inquiry. Maybe some people should have been put on trial and sent to prison. So the whole thing of having inquiries is a way of kicking stuff into the long grass. And of course, that's why the Pat Finucane Centre in Belfast has never been in favour of a British inquiry into the collusion between the Loyalist paramilitaries and the British Army, because they don't believe that British inquiries are designed to get to the truth. They're designed to obfuscate the truth. So what should have happened there when it all started coming out? You shouldn't set up an inquiry. You should start honest police officers prosecuting other police officers.
I mean, the Director of Public Prosecutions is potentially an incredibly corrupt role. We saw Kamala Harris, who's the vice president for Joe Biden now. She was involved as the chief prosecutor in the state of California. And there's a whole list. I think it was your candidate, Tulsi Gabbard, who exposed a lot of that. You know, she basically went through all the records of the various miscarriages of justice that Kamala Harris had been responsible for. I mean, she's touted as, oh, isn't it great? We've got the first black woman vice president. Actually, let's have a look at her track record. and see whether she's corrupt or not. Isn't that more important than the colour of her skin? Anyway, finally, Martin, before we have a break and go on to part two in a minute after some music, the SNP has sacked Joanna Cherry. And she was, of course, a bit of a loyalist to the previous leader of the SNP, Alex Salmon. She sacked Joanna Cherry this week from her front bench role, but people are saying that this was carried out to deflect criticism of Scotland's COVID-19 vaccination programme, which actually Joanna Cherry was very critical of. She was a critical voice within Nicola Sturgeon's cabinet, and now she's been hoofed out.
Yeah, well, I mean, she was an ally of Alex Salmond, and of course there's an awful lot of bad blood between Salmond and Sturgeon. I mean, it's possible that all of this, we were just been talking about infiltration and manipulation of political movements. This is the SNP's big moment. They're going to win the Holyrood election. They're then going to push towards a referendum. But if internal fighting within the SNP poisons that chalice, I can imagine that MI5 definitely probably are involved in the attempts to make Alex Salmond, for example. You know, it looks as if there's been collusion in order to try and get him convicted of sexual assault, and there's all sorts of bad blood going on. And of course, it actually spoils their electoral prospects to some extent. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to find the hand of the Secret Services behind that.
Definitely, probably. Which is it?
I would probably say definitely, Tony. Because I'm that way inclined.
Final story before the news. We're going to hear it now from a guy called Jonathan Rosenthal, who's a Labour chair of a local constituency Labour Party and a Labour activist who's been accused of anti-Semitism. As I mean, I've been being accused of anti-Semitism for, gosh, the last 30 years, probably, on and off. You know, obviously you have to take these claims seriously, but it is being used as a smear. Can you just generally say something, Martin, about the way anti-Semitism is being used to shut down debate? Because obviously there is some real hatred of Jews out there, and actually my experience of it and prejudice against Jews has been within the Conservative Party, within the right wing of the Conservative Party, not in the Labour Party. But yet again, it's being we're being told that the Labour Party is a hotbed of anti-Semitism. Jonathan Rosenhead, who is Jewish himself, is an anti-Semite.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's obviously it's been weaponized by the Israeli state, basically. I mean, they were behind Shaim Mossad, who's also, of course, a colleague of the new guy who's going to be doing social media for the Labour Party.
Oh God,
and
yes,
his job will be to check on everybody's social media accounts to make sure that they're not criticising the state of Israel. That's how embedded these people are in the structure. Of course, it's absolutely ludicrous that large numbers of Jewish members of the Labour Party are being expelled on the grounds that they're anti-Semitic because of their anti-Israeli government positions.
Okay.
You couldn't make it up, but there it is. But yeah, I think if people are interested in this, they should get on. I'm on the Jewish Voice for Labour blog, and they send out emails every day with very, very well-argued articles about all of this, and lots of statements by the people on the receiving end. You don't have to be Jewish to be part of Jewish Voice for Labour. You can be a supporter. I'm a non-Jewish supporter of theirs. They are an extremely good and worthwhile organisation.
Yeah, you know what? Almost none of it gets reported in the mainstream press. But anyway, let's hear now, because we're not the mainstream press, the voice of Jonathan Rosenhead, the Jewish Labour Party member and activist for decades, who's now being accused within the Labour Party of anti-Semitism. Just another one of hundreds of people who've been accused the same, probably at least, I'm sure, scores of Jews as well. So let's have a listen to Jonathan Rosenhead now.
A group of Labour Party members, concerned about the clampdown on freedom of speech and lack of natural justice affecting many members, are going to the High Court to seek change. Jonathan Rosenhead is a retired Jewish academic in his early 80s who lives in London. He He first joined the Labour Party in Sheffield in 1962.
I was a Labour candidate, parliamentary candidate, back in 1966, but I rejoined the party most recently in 2015 with the election of Jeremy Corbyn. In May of 2020, I received a notice of investigation from the Labour Party accusing me of terrible things, three things in particular, and those three things were, in respectively, they were wrong, they were vague, and they were a joke. So I'd go through those three one by one. The thing that was wrong was they asserted that I had made certain statements about Ken Livingstone when a witness at his disciplinary hearing, to the effect that he was, nothing he'd said or done was anti-Semitic. Now, I didn't use the words which they described. What's more, they didn't have the words because there was no transcript of the hearing. It was in confidence, etc. And so they were making it up. The one that was vague, well, they said, they asked me if I'd written a particular article, which I had in 2017. The trouble was it was 3,000 words long. And they didn't tell me which of the words that had got me into trouble. So they were inviting me to imagine what I could have said that might be seen as anti-Semitic and then defend myself against the assertion. Well, that's not the way justice usually works. The third one, the joke, was a joke that I didn't make. It was a joke that Joe Bird made and got her suspended for a few days. And it was about a play on words between due process, which the Labour Party disciplinary proceedings don't have, and due process. Now, it's her joke, not mine, but when I was nominating her at my CLP for a place on the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party, I reminded them who she was by saying she had made the joke about due process, which was quite well known. And for even mentioning the fact that she had made that joke, I am apparently, conceivably, anti-Semitic. So those are the three charges: error-strewn, vague, and humorless. Still the process. It's an unfit process. It's an unjust process. It causes confusion. It causes stress to thousands of people. We don't need any more witch hunts. We don't need any witch hunts at all. What we need is justice.
Labour Activists for Justice is bringing a case against the Labour Party regarding these injustices. Please support us by donating to our legal fund and sharing this video.
Okay, so, that was the voice of Jonathan Rosenhead, Labour activist. Martin, this is a pretty disgusting situation, isn't it? Where do you think, who's going to win this outcome of the Labour Party? Because it's a tug of war, it seems to me, between the pro-Israeli factions and the pro-Palestinian factions. And I'm rather concerned that if there is, this conflict does escalate in the Middle East, that there may be an attempt to make sure that the Labour Party is on one side and not the other side in that conflict.
Yeah, I think the other thing underlying all of this is that it's about the position on the Iraq war as much as anything else. A lot of the Labour Party panjun drums on the right of the party who are banging the drum about anti-Semitism all voted to go to war in Iraq and probably kill millions of people. So that's what this really underlyingly is about. A lot of what's going on, I think it's extraordinary that somebody like Keir Starmer, a lawyer, former director of public prosecutions, doesn't realise that the legal basis for what they're doing doesn't exist. And as long as we can get it into court, the Labour Party, I mean, we paid off the people that claimed that they were being basically been discriminated against. The legal advice the Labour Party was given, Corbyn was still the leader at that stage, is that if it went to court, the Labour Party would win. But Starmer, once he was elected, said, we're not going to go to court. And he gave millions of pounds of Labour Party membership subscriptions to these people. And those very people were also reported in another in the Ford report, I think it was, that they've been deliberately using their positions as Labour Party officials to undermine the possibility of winning the election. And not only were they doing that as a fifth column inside the Labour Party, they've now been given millions of pounds worth of damages out of the subs, which people like me have been paying weekly since 1975. It's outrageous. But of course, ultimately, we are going to go to court. This is all going to end up in court. And the Labour Party is going to have to pay damages to a lot of the people that whose names they have libelled. I mean, anti-Semitism is an outrageous criminal. It should be dealt with very severely. Frivolous allegations of anti-Semitism should be dealt with equally seriously. Ultimately, the Labour Party is going to end up in court about all of this, and it's going to lose. And then I imagine what many of the activists will do is donate their damages back to the party. That's what I'd do if I was in their position. But Starmer's on the hiding to nothing about this. What he could have done is tried to draw a line over under the whole thing and move on. But instead, because he's under pressure from people like Margaret Hodge, the Daily Mail, the British Board of Deputies, the British Jews, who openly support the Conservative Party, they are going to supposedly be involved in the internal disciplinary structures of the Labour Party. And of course, this is basically going to create all kinds of problems for the Labour Party, going to make it very difficult for us to move on from all of this. But that's Starmer's decision. That's how it's going to be. Well, and ultimately, of course, we need to change the electoral system so that if people are kicked out of the Labour Party, it becomes viable to run parties to their left.
Labour Party's got to get its house in order. We don't hear anything on these topics from our Mayor, Marvin Rees. It's almost as if he's just looking the other way and hoping it all goes away.
Well, there were two possibilities in dealing with this situation. One was to move on and say, look, we're moving on from this. The other is there's basically the Israeli embassy who are behind all of this. I'm no doubt about it. They have got a finger in this pie. Shai Mossat said to Joan Ryan when she was still a Labour MP on the record, as captured by Al Jazeera, I've got £1 million to spend to create youth movements which will undermine Corbyn. So they're very, very interested in the direction of the Labour Party. They put a lot of effort into it. And of course, what we're ultimately talking about here is US taxpayers' money, because the state of Israel is essentially a welfare state kept in place with US taxes.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar what's happened to me just over the last day or so with threats against me as anti-Semitism, supposedly, with my book, The Siege of Heaven, is apparently anti-Semitic. The same thing has happened to Jonathan Rosenhead, has happened to me, where they said, well, this thing is anti-Semitic, but they don't actually say where it's anti-Semitic and in what way it's anti-Semitic. So you've got to kind of guess. It's very much like the way YouTube take videos down for medical misinformation, where they don't actually tell you what the medical misinformation is. Effectively, what's going on here is people are just taking you out, taking you down, removing your files, censoring you because they can.
Yeah, and in any case, even if the book was anti-Semitic, which I don't accept and you don't accept it is, you've got no right to ban it, even if it is. I mean, you can kick people out of the Labour Party because there's an internal structure of discipline there. And people should be kicked out for making frivolous allegations, I would say. But of course, something like a book which is available on the internet, how can you ban that? You can't, in fact. Well, so what are they on about?
Some people will try and do that. Of course, if you're telling the truth, quite often, if you'll find somebody somewhere is trying to squash you and stop you doing that. Anyway, you can still download, I hope, my book, The Siege of Heaven, which is a watermark version from bilderberg.org, and you'll find the links on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But we managed to do quite well there, not talking about COVID at all. Lots and lots going on that isn't COVID for an hour and a half, but we're going to have some music now. And I thought it'd be nice to listen to some voices from the 60s and 70s folk scene. And so we're going to hear a song from Fairport Convention and Sandy Denny from 1969, and then from Maddie Pryor, and Steel I Span in 1975. We'll be back after this talking COVID.
and I cannot find none. And sing all the hard times of old England. In old England, very hard times. Provisions you buy at the shop, it is true, but if you've no money, there's none there.
from 1975 there, Maddie Pryor and Steel Ice Band. I don't know how she managed to get from the hard times into the good times, but I think that's where we are now, really. It'd be nice to have a bit of good times, wouldn't it? And before that, it's Sandy Denny and Fairport Convention with Who Knows Where the Time Goes, 1969. She sadly died 9 years after that. Fell down the stairs, poor Sandy, but Maddie Pryor's still going. And I thought it's quite fascinating to see that they, including Maddie, are doing a concert in Derbyshire in May this year. Led as ever by the iconic Maddie Pryor, seven-piece group will tour Buxton Opera House on May the 8th and Chesterfield's Winding Wheel on May the 11th. Steel Ice Band were propelled to fame in the 1970s. The tickets for Buxton are £25.50 and Chesterfield £27.50, and I would imagine I'd be very surprised if she won't be singing that song we just heard. But anyway, Martin, I thought we'd better start by just looking at some figures, because the statistics have been manipulated by all sides, I think, in this pandemic, whatever you want to call it. 31st of January this year, just a few days ago, we had 5,170 adult critical care beds occupied in England, over 1,500 more than at any point in the past five winters. So, you know, there are people who are saying, oh, well, the NHS, in fact, I've said this, the NHS, you know, is actually always at this time of year is in crisis, and particularly with the intensive care beds. I mean, we've had several stories over the last decade or so with intensive care across the country filled up, not with COVID, but with just because of the fact we haven't got enough intensive care beds. But we do have 1,500 more. That's around about, looking at the percentages, about 25% more than we did have over the last five winters. And looking at the excess deaths as well, there's been 104,000 excess deaths in the past year. That's over the five-year average. So some years before that were up and some were down. But this last year in 2020 was 104,000 excess deaths. Now, of course, from those statistics come all sorts of other questions, like, are people being treated properly for COVID, or are they being treated for the flu and for pneumonia when they should be maybe getting ivermectin and chloroquine, and they wouldn't necessarily be in all those intensive care beds, for the first question? And the second question is, many of these excess deaths may well be simply people who were too scared to go to hospital to get any treatment, or whose treatment dried up. So I just wondered if you want to say what you make, Martin, of this whole business of statistics and the way they've been used throughout this pandemic in order to try and twist the truth to whichever agenda whoever wants says it. Because I can remember, I think it was the Hector Drummond website was one of the best, I don't know if he's still doing it, but putting graphs out based on the official statistics, which gave you a very different impression. For example, saying something which we never heard on the BBC, that the number of people that actually died of COVID in the first half of the first 6 months of the pandemic were, guess what, 600 or so who had actually died of COVID. All the rest have had other conditions as well at the same time. So statistics can be misused, and I'm sure that you'll agree they have been being misused.
Well, as you say, there's a kind of war of statistics going on, and people are making all sorts of claims and counterclaims. I'm keeping half an eye on this as everybody else is. And if we've got 104,000 excess deaths over the last 5 years, over the average of the last 5 years, and we've had three lockdowns, then I think the idea that COVID is no real threat is basically for the birds.
I don't think anyone's saying that, Martin, you see.
Well, some people are, Tony, they are.
It's not a credible argument. I mean, the trouble is that lots of people are dying because of the results of the fear, and we're seeing deliberate fear being put out, you know, unrealistic adverts put out by the government which are designed to scare people, particularly frail elderly people, which are just not realistic, and then they're actually inaccurate, and they'd have to be withdrawn by the Advertising Standards Authority. Things like this, the idea of using fear as a tactic. I mean, I was over in New Zealand when this all started back in March last year, and they had the government announcements there, but they were nothing like our announcements. They were all just basically not talking down to people, explaining to people what was going on and why it would be sensible if maybe they didn't go out, this sort of thing. And also, very importantly, that the main message in New Zealand was be kind. You know, so this is the kind way to do things. Over here, there's been this rather nasty conservative-led bullying attitude where you've just got to do what the government says or you're going to die. Now, you know, this is actually talking down to people and it's not bringing people along with whatever their policy happens to be.
Yeah, well, I think that the government's communication strategies have been execrable. One of the things I'd like to pick up on is the fact that there's over 8,000 workplaces have been found to be in breach of COVID regulations, but not one of them has been prosecuted and not one of them has been fined. Meanwhile, people who have parties in their gardens and so on are being fined huge amounts of money.
Yeah, but stop a second, because there is another way to intervene, and that is to step in and say, well, we think you should change the way you do things before you actually start fining people. You know, the idea that the first thing you do is come in and immediately fine someone because they've put a chair, 3 inches in the wrong direction is not necessarily a good idea. I mean, you seem to be saying that the best way to deal with this is to threaten people.
I think I think that they've gone too far on the threatening thing for ordinary people doing ordinary stuff. What they haven't done is deal with the bad bosses who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And that's, of course, because the Tory party is keen to get the economy moving again. We've got Rishi Sunak now pushing to reopen the economy as quickly as possible. And it now becomes clear that his eat out to help out, which costs 600 million of our money, has actually led us into second and third lockdowns. He is actually a very dangerous man, more dangerous than Boris, who doesn't know what's going on, what day of the week it is.
Yeah, there's no evidence for that, Martin. What evidence have you got?
What evidence for what? Rishi Sunak's position, I was reading about it earlier. He is pushing
Eat out to help out.
Eat out to help out. There's a study out there. I can send you the link and you can put it on our show page.
Okay,
shows that in actual fact, it led to increasing infections, which then led to the lockdowns. It was, with hindsight, it was a stupid idea. And I think this is what's going. If there is an inquiry, all of this will come out. But we're still not at what we've got with the COVID research group and Sunak trying to manoeuvre himself into the prime minister's position is that they are pushing already to try and get out of the lockdown we're in against the advice of Sage.
Isn't Rishi Sunak just implementing Goldman Sachs policy in the British Treasury?
Yes, I mean, of course, the fact is that somebody like Rishi Sunak was working for Goldman Sachs here in 2008. He's probably one of the, unlike Nick, who we were talking about earlier, he's probably somebody who should have been sent to prison and had all of his assets confiscated. And that would have been, if they confiscate the assets of the people that are involved, then that can balance the books, can't it?
MP, and you can't become Chancellor. It does
well,
seem...
Indeed. Yeah. And he's actually had a good war so far. People liked the idea of the furlough, for example. Good idea, but it wasn't his idea. That was the Treasury's idea. And, of course, he's tried to row back on the principle of paying people to stay home as much as possible. And, of course, that eventually they've just been forced to accept that that's what you've got to do. And ultimately, the magic money tree will work. You can carry on printing money indefinitely. Ultimately, of course, you've got to pay it back or you've got to balance the books somehow. And the way you do that is by having wealth taxes. But, of course, Rishi Sunak's wife is richer than the Queen. So he doesn't want to see wealth taxes, nor do any of his friends.
I doubt that. If you talk to Kevin Cahill, now she's on our show before we were booted off the airwaves quite regularly, and of course we should get him back on Skype or something whilst we're online only for the time being. But, I mean, he would say the Queen was very, very much more wealthy, and she uses a lot of her power, and many people do, including the Rothschild family, to hide their wealth to make sure that they don't pop up too high on the Sunday Times rich list. And in fact, I can even remember one year, must have been about maybe 12, 15 years ago, seeing the Sunday Times rich list. And next to it was an advert for Chateau Mousse Rothschild wine as a sort of I suppose a cheeky little joke, in joke, for those that are in the know, that Mr. Rothschild was, Jacob Rothschild we're talking about here, was on the rich list, really, but only as a wine advert rather than being listed as one of the richest people in the world. The Queen is very similar. They like to hide their wealth. They're very good at hiding their wealth, and they're very good at controlling the press. In fact, as Kevin explained, that they would get threatening letters at the Sunday Times from the royal household saying, you know, this is not the case, and there will be legal action taken against you if you say it is. And of course, you can't really take on the crown, even if you are Rupert Murdoch and the editor of the Sunday Times. But anyway, Martin, a bit belatedly, I'll say welcome back to the BCFM Politics Show. Well, it's not really BCFM. It's not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. And we've got quite a lot to get through, so let's try and crack through it. We've done a bit of number crunching there. Also going to look in a minute at Pemberley Care Home in Basingstoke, where a third of the residents, that's 22 elderly people, die just after getting the vaccines in the care home. This is a bit of a mystery as to why this has happened, but it's pretty horrendous. 22 elderly people dead just as the vaccines are introduced there in Basingstoke, at £15 billion profit. Now, not £15 billion turnover, £15 billion profit for Pfizer. The hedge funds are happy, but I thought this was supposed to be a not-for-profit exercise, not for Pfizer, obviously. And is it safe? We had the 2019 MHRA mesh scandal, so the regulators, well, I mean, they need to be properly looked at. Ambulance staff in Wales refusing the vaccine, something else we have heard about only in a couple of little newspapers in Wales, not really anywhere else in the country. But it's interesting that paramedics in Wales, some of them don't want the vaccine at all. They want nothing to do with it. And this is another angle to this whole pandemic, which is not being discussed, is that those who, particularly healthcare workers, who are saying, no, I don't want a vaccine. When I was over in New Zealand, they explained to me that there were quite a lot of healthcare workers there that didn't want to have the flu vaccine. So they told them, you're going to have to wear a mask unless you take the flu vaccine. And some held out, but after a few weeks, they'd all had the flu vaccine. And they didn't have to wear their masks at work all the time. Now, this, to me, is using the mask to coerce and bully people into something that they don't actually agree with through informed consent. So it's just a way of getting around the law and the ethics of medicine. Anyway, so also some spiritual or political, Dr. Rashid Buttar, a bit of hippie stuff from the United States about the pandemic. He's a doctor. We always like to have at least a couple of doctors on every week here with second opinions on what you're getting on the BBC. An assassination of Brandy Vaughan. She was working for the company Merck, but she died in suspicious circumstances back in November, and we're going to be hearing from her. Before she died, she recorded a very interesting tape of what was going on, a film in her house with it being broken into, intimidation against her that forced her to move out of the city. And also on climate change, extreme weather in Bristol 400 years ago, our old friend Dr. Evan Jones from the Cabot Project in the history department at Bristol University has come out with some amazing stories about crazy stuff going on 400 years ago in the Bristol Channel freezing over. And also the US accused Russia of microwaving their diplomats. US visitor to the UK, Anne Sekulis, admits finally after killing Harry Dunn that she was actually working for US intelligence. And of course, she should never have had diplomatic immunity. Anonymous accusation as well of anti-Semitism to get my book, The Siege of Heaven, taken offline. We covered that in the first hour, so we won't go back there. Ofcom cancelling the license for China's CNTV. We also talked about that. But what we will be talking about is the death of Sir Brian Urquhart, the former Deputy Director General of the United Nations, and more importantly, from my point of view, the intelligence officer for Operation Market Garden, who was sacked by Frederick Browning, the main instigator of the sabotage of that operation, which gave the Nazis an extra 4 months in order to squirrel their wealth away at the end of the war and sacrifice tens of thousands of soldiers, British and American, in the 1st Airborne Division and the 82nd Airborne and the 101st Airborne Division in September 1944. And finally, the JFK assassination, Chicago mob hitman. While we're on the topic of the 82nd Airborne Division, James Files talks about his CIA controller, the guy that made sure that Kennedy was dead his name, David Attlee Phillips, and you'll be hearing that at the end of the show. But Martin, this care home in Basingstoke, let's just go back to there. I mean, it's pretty horrific, isn't it, for anyone who's got a relative in a care home like that, that when the people turn up to vaccinate, within the space of a week or so after they start vaccinating people, one third of the residents in the care home die. Now, obviously, nobody knows whether this is because the people giving the vaccinations were bringing COVID in or whether the vaccine has killed them. But obviously, the vaccine companies, the private vaccine companies, do not want the word to go out that the vaccine can possibly lead to this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I saw this. I mean, it may be. I mean, the way it's being finessed by the authorities is that it's very unfortunate and it's just a coincidence. Because don't forget, with both AstraZeneca and the Pfizer vaccine, you don't get immediate coverage, specifically with the Pfizer vaccine, because it's got a different methodology than traditional vaccines. It tricks your own bodily system into, you know, creating, and therefore it takes a while to you know, your body has to be tuned into the vaccine.
As Stanley Laham said on our show, your cells become the virus. Well, he wasn't actually saying your cell does turn into a virus. He wasn't saying that at all. He was illustrating that the mRNA vaccines trick your cells into producing the spike protein on the outside of the virus, which then provokes an immune response. And the main problem with these mRNAs is that they can, according to Stanley Laham, not according to me, a lifelong immunologist from Florida University, can provoke an immune response which can turn into autoimmune disease in the long term. And also, these cells can be in your organs and it can affect your organs maybe for many, many years to come. The main problem, of course, with the mRNAs and Pfizer, as I mentioned there, the $15 billion profit for Pfizer, is they hedge funds are laughing, Martin. They are clapping. They're cheering. A great victory. More profits. We've got a massive return on our investment. But the thing is that the health side of it and the health checks and balances have been subverted by these people. They managed to get this through as an experimental vaccine, something which they've been trying to get approved for 15 years or more without success. The pandemic has given this an opportunity. And now they're saying $15 billion in profit.
Yeah, well, I think the Pfizer vaccine is clearly disaster capitalism. I don't think there's anything else you can call it. It costs about $30 a shot compared to the AstraZeneca $3 and the Sputnik and Chinese, you know, vaccines much cheaper. And, of course, in the developing world, they're not going to go with Pfizer at all. And, of course, Pfizer bought, I think it's Borlaug, I can't remember the name of the CEO, he bought an option on his shares, and the day they announced that they got this vaccine and it was going to be rolling out, he made a killing on the stock market on the back of that insider trading statement. So they are definitely disaster capitalists, no doubt about that. And of course, the British government have bought loads and loads of these vaccines, so we put money in these people's pockets. I think we shouldn't touch them with a barge pole. And of course, it is possible that what they've done there is that they've actually given people COVID with the vaccine. Now, we don't know if that's true or not yet, but well, if it does turn out that by getting the Pfizer vaccine, and my father has had both Pfizer jabs, you're actually spreading COVID, then there's going to be the scandal is going to be enormous.
I did try and find out whether that care home had had the AstraZeneca or the Pfizer, and it proved impossible to figure it out. Maybe that's deliberate. It was also interesting, of course, one of the things they don't talk about is vitamin D, and they did talk about it at Prime Minister's Questions. It was great to see David Davis from the Tories bringing this up. There's all sorts of treatments that we talk about on here, like ivermectin and chloroquine, which doctors are begging the authorities to start using. Of course, these are very cheap out-of-patent drugs, most of them, which won't make anybody a massive profit, like Pfizer managed to get there. But vitamin D, zinc, and vitamin C, as well as ivermectin and chloroquine, can be really, really effective treatments. And it's great to see someone at least bringing some of this up at Prime Minister's Questions. So let's have a listen to the Prime Minister's Questions clip on vitamin D now.
David Davis.
Thank you,
Speaker, may I congratulate my right honourable friend on his calm handling of the European Commission's misbehaviour over vaccines in Northern Ireland. Nevertheless, we can learn something from our European friends. Andalusia, a Spanish province of 8 million people, had a COVID death rate of about 190 deaths per million in November, higher than ours at the time. After giving activated vitamin D, calcifediol, to care home residents and some GP patients, that death rate almost halved, whilst ours was doubling. Can he ask his advisers to look urgently again at the very latest Spanish research about this cheap, safe and apparently effective treatment?
I'm very grateful to my right honourable friend, and we will continue to monitor all the evidence about the efficacy of vitamin D in the treatment that he mentions. I'm well aware of it, and indeed we've discussed it before personally, Mr. Speaker, and I'll keep him updated on the review that's currently taking place.
Martin, one of the interesting things, and we've maybe put this up on our show page, is the Janet Street Porter, about 2 weeks ago, was congratulating Tom Moore for having the vaccine. That article was changed and removed from the Daily Mail on Wednesday this week, and it was then removed anything saying that he'd had the vaccine. So there seems to be a little bit of dispute in the press about whether he had the vaccine or not. So that, you know, and of course it would have been terrible news if he'd had the vaccine and then died at 100 years of age after being such a hero and saving the NHS, for if this terrible possibility that the NHS might have been involved in his death, but by giving him a vaccine that potentially killed him. But that was obviously removed from the... And I'm not saying that that happened. I'm absolutely not saying that it happened, but it was there on the Daily Mail's website for weeks up until the time he actually died. And in Janet Street Porter's article, it actually said that he had had the jab.
Well, I didn't know that. I heard his family said that he hadn't had the jab because he'd had pneumonia and they thought he was too weak. But anyway, we'll have to look into that and find out what actually happened.
What do you make of his death? Is it a big milestone or what?
Well, I mean, he's 100 years old and, he was, not many people live to that age. And of course, he's kind of represented what the mood of the country as it was this time last year, before Dominic Cummings went to Barnard Castle and before all the other things that have happened. And, there's not much point. I mean, he raised all that money for the NHS, but of course he couldn't actually pay it directly to the NHS. You're not allowed to do that because that would then allow the government to cut the money to the NHS. It went to NHS charities. I'm sure it went to good stuff, but it didn't go directly to the NHS, which is what people have to realise. Because if the NHS must be funded, these are the rules, by the government. You can't just have people funding the mainstream NHS stuff, because that then lets the government off the hook. And, of course, the government have underfunded the NHS since the austerity budgets of Osborne. And, of course, we now know that that was all totally unnecessary. They could easily have printed the money, and they chose not to. Now they're doing it because they haven't got an option.
Okay, so we've also got ambulance staff in Wales refusing the COVID-19 vaccination. This has also not been talked about much. Now, they're talking about something like 25, 30% of paramedics do not want the vaccination. Now, this is the wrong story, isn't it, Martin?
Well, I haven't seen the story, so I don't know. You know, I mean, it's possible. It's quite likely some people don't want to be vaccinated.
It's just a story from the South Wales Argus, but I'm surprised that it hasn't gone a little bit further, because if paramedics, who know so much about life and death, the immune system, COVID, vaccines, that sort of thing, have decided they don't want to have this vaccine, then maybe what we're getting from the mainstream press is rather a hard sell, because there's anybody that's not having it, like these paramedics, are being classified as anti-vaxxers.
Well, as you know, there's the term anti-vaxxers is not very revealing. Some people are totally against any kind of vaccination, as Jehovah's Witnesses, for example. Other people I'm definitely agnostic about it. I mean, you can't just presume, especially when you've got Pfizer, which is essentially a a profit-making scam, would you buy a used car from these people? And the answer is no. And of course, but what should be happening is that public goods like vaccines should be produced for public good. They shouldn't be produced for private profit. And in some parts of the world, Russia, China, Cuba, that is exactly what they do. They produce, and what we should do, if we're going to have a nationalised national health service, is we should nationalise the pharmaceutical companies so that they don't basically go out creating illness so that they can cure it for profit. It's a nonsense. And of course, it's got real economic effects in places like the United States, where they spend a massive amount of their gross national product on second-rate, third-rate healthcare, which means, of course, that their industries are uncompetitive because the people basically have to spend a huge chunk of their income. You get ill in the United States and you go bankrupt. And that means, of course, that people's wages have to be that much higher, which means you can't compete with China, et cetera, et cetera. It's a nonsense. And ultimately, that's got to be put. I mean, what may happen as a result of all of this is a commitment to public healthcare, publicly owned, publicly delivered. And that's what I've always believed in anyway. Staring everybody in the face. That's what you got to do.
That would be nice to see, as long as it's better managed than the NHS on things like chloroquine. And we haven't got this revolving door between the private vaccine business, drug companies, the big pharma, as well as these massive foundations like the Wellcome Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, other things which have got themselves very much involved in medicine, and the policy-making groups like NervTag and Sage. Then I would definitely go along with what you're saying, Martin. But these people need to be weeded out. They need to be sacked, as Mike Yeadon said, for completely taking over, basically occupying and invading the policies. Before we go on to talk more about COVID, there's a couple of international stories. This one intrigued me this week. It's Gordon Carrera at the BBC saying that the Russians seem to be targeting CIA spies with secret microwave weapons in order to make them sick and ill, pointing microwave beams into their homes, that sort of thing.
Well, I knew people who were camped at Greenham Common back in the 80s, and they were pretty convinced that they were being, they would beam stuff at them, and then everybody would start throwing up and being ill. So they've got, these things exist for sure. But when you've got the Western media going about the Russians are doing this, the Russians are doing that, they poisoned Navalny with Novichok, not just any old poison, it's got to be Novichok. I just discount an awful lot of it, because basically they're beating the drums for war with Russia and China. So they're trying to, basically, they're the bad guys, and we're being told constantly all the bad things that they do. They're cyber war. They're trying to bend our minds. They're putting poison in the water supply. In fact, I saw some Russians hiding in a bush earlier when I went into town. I haven't reported them yet, but maybe I will.
What Gordon's career is saying, that this is really just intelligence cut and pasted onto the BBC. After Russia's interference in the 2016 US presidential elections, CIA leadership issued a call to arms and redeployed battle-hardened officers to push back. But he eventually became acting chief, this guy Polymeropoulos, I think it sounds like Greek origin guy, chief of clandestine operations in Europe and Eurasia, and it concluded the 2018 poisoning of former Russian spy Sergei Skripal in Salisbury, England, that he was working on. In December 2017, he visited Moscow, not undercover. He wanted to use a regular liaison meeting between Russians and US spies to see the country for himself. He was not there, he insists, for any clandestine activity, but it was early on during the trip that he fell ill. On his return to the US, the vertigo went, but other symptoms persisted to this day. I've had a migraine headache for 3 straight years, he says. It's never gone away, he told the BBC. Unable to work a full day and took months off, starting a long medical journey. So, I mean, there's got to be... I mean, something's going on here, Martin. What is it?
a lot of propaganda about how evil the Russians are. The Navalny story just gets more and more ridiculous. I mean, the supposedly Novichok on the plastic bottle, which was carried to Germany on the plane, and then given to a military lab, and they said, "Oh, we found Novichok on the bottle. It's on the bottle." And then we got Bellingcat, who were a front for MI6, CIA, saying, "No, no, no, we've got evidence that it was on his underpants." And of course, in any case, none of this makes sense because Novichok is a military grade chemical weapon designed to wipe out a whole division of tanks or something of that sort. And it's certainly not the sort of thing that you can pose in an individual with without poisoning everybody around them. The bottle with the Novichok on, which was supposedly taken from Navalny's hotel in Omsk, it was carried to Germany and given to the Germans to look at. And they said, they can't quite make up their mind. So it was Novichok on the bottle, or was it on his underpants? And in any case, Novichok is a military-grade weapon. If you wanted to poison somebody, it's not the sort of thing you would use. And in any case, he's still alive. So what is all this about? And, of course, what's happening is that this is a whole theatre for, I mean, all this stuff about the Russian involvement in the US election. What that comes down to is that the emails of the Democratic National Committee were given by Seth Rich, probably, who was the IT guy, to Craig Murray from WikiLeaks, and they published it, which showed that the primary process in the Democratic Party in the US was being fixed. Now, nobody disputes that's what they show, but the Democrats then immediately jumped up and down and said, what this shows is that the Russians have got in here and they've discredited American democracy by showing these people these emails. But they didn't deny what was in the emails. What the emails showed is that the Western CIA secret services were rigging the election. And of course, that's been parleyed, and you can read it in The Guardian any day from anybody. We all know that the Russians fixed the election. It's absolute rubbish. But of course, there's plenty of people out there who don't pay too much attention who think they know that that's what happened. But of course, that's not what happened at all. The election was being fixed by the CIA, not by the Russians.
Charles Shoebridge on this show, former army officer and special branch officer, he explained that MI5's press officers were basically Gordon Carrera. An MI6 press officer, Gordon Carrera, that the intelligence and security correspondents for the national press were basically just doing MI5's press releases. And that's effectively what they were, because they don't hold press conferences. They just phone up these correspondents and tell them what to think and what to say. And then they just say it as if that's news.
Yeah, I mean, it's all based on the idea. Insiders tell me this, that and the other. And of course, what people have got to realise that intelligence services are basically their stock in trade is disinformation. The real sharp end of it, like bugging the phone call between Umas Piets and Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign affairs person, where he's told her that the people that had been shot down in the Maidan Square in 2014 were being shot down by the new regime. And it came out as a court case in Kiev that in actual fact it was a 50 mercenaries who'd been brought in from Georgia by Shakashvili, and they had shot these people down. They were working for NATO intelligence services. That's already been proved in a court of law in Kiev. But everybody thinks they know that the Russians did it and all the rest of it, except that they didn't. And of course, what happens is because people have been given a diet of nonsense from James Bond from years and years ago. And as you know, Tony, Ian Fleming, who wrote those books, was actually involved in the extraction of Bormann from Berlin in 1945. People think they know what, you know, they've got this very vague idea about the Russians are all run by secret service. Putin used to be in the KGB. Yes, he did. And George Bush Sr. used to be the head of the CIA. And the real world is actually full of interactions between politicians and intelligence services. And the idea that we are the good guys and they're the bad guys and that's all there is to it is a load of rubbish. It just is. It defies common sense, frankly.
Martin, there's all sorts of other stuff going on as well. We've had a general strike. I mean, I don't know if you've heard about this, a general strike over in Nepal where they've dissolved parliament, and it's effectively a bit like, I mean, we've heard loads about Burma, Myanmar this week, but nothing much about Nepal. What do you make of both or either or not, you know, of those interventions in, and I guess we're talking really here about Asia, Southeast Asia, but particularly Burma.
Well, I mean, in Burma, the Takmador, the military, they've always been the power behind the scenes in Burma. So it's not that much of a surprise that they've decided. There was an election last November, which Aung San Suu Kyi's party won pretty convincingly, and they're not very happy about that, so they've moved against her. Incidentally, of course, the Rohingyas who've been persecuted, you know, the shine came off Aung San Suu Kyi because she went along with military persecution of the Rohingyas. But, of course, the Rohingyas aren't being offered passports to come to Britain, like the Hong Kong Chinese, or the Palestinians who are stateless in Palestinian refugee camps in Syria and Lebanon. And if we're going to start the habit of people in countries that used to be British colonies having a right to come here if they're being persecuted, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? But, of course, we're not, because nobody would even think of saying such a thing. But, of course, the Hong Kong Chinese, several million of them may be turning up here. And, of course, they could perhaps be put into Northern Ireland to make sure that they outvote the local nationalists. I don't know. That's the sort of thing that used to happen in the British Empire. They brought loads of people from southern India into Sri Lanka because they needed people to work on their tea plantations. And that then led to civil war subsequently. Maybe those people should be allowed to come as well. I don't know. But since we're so open-hearted to people that used to be part of our empire, maybe we should consider doing that.
Well, I mean, the British Empire wasn't all bad, Martin. There were some good things that done, the spread of Christianity, for example. And maybe the reason that we're in such a load of nonsense now is because we gave up on Christianity. It seems to me that that's just been thrown out of the door as if it doesn't matter. And in fact, main Christian institutions seem to be full up with all sorts of people that shouldn't be there, as Vernon Coleman will be hearing from in a little while talks about this week. But anyway, let's start on one of the most serious topics that I'm going to be looking at tonight, and that is this lady, Brandy Vaughan. She was from Merck, and now she's dead. We're going to have a listen now to 5 minutes or so of her describing before she died. Merck is a massive pharmaceutical, continental pharmaceutical company. And here she is before she died, talking about the situation in her home. She found her home broken into and various obvious things like ladders up against open windows, back windows opened so that they would be easy to get into. And she was so intimidated by this, quite obviously, that she had to leave the city. And then in November, beginning of November last year, she was found dead. So let's have a listen now to the extraordinary Brandy Vaughan talking about her home being raided by one. Can you imagine are people who have been hired by the pharmaceutical industry to intimidate her, because she, as an ex-employee, knew a lot about the pharmaceutical industry, and she was going out on demonstrations against it. So maybe they saw her as some sort of traitor in their little cult. Anyway, so Brandy Vaughan now, ex-employee of Merck, now dead, speaking it just a month or so before she died last year about the infiltration of her home.
According to the alarm company, at 3:45 in the morning, somebody entered in through the front door, the alarm went off. They disabled the alarm by putting in the master code right away into the panel. And then at 3:46 in the morning, my hallway monitor sensor went off. So someone went down the hall. And then at 3:48, someone opened my dining room window and then closed it right away. And then if you notice, the dining room window actually faces out towards the backyard, which is much more private than the front door, which they used to enter that time. And then they went over to the keypad, entered the code again, and then left through the front door at 3:49. After the incident, I talked to some security experts who have actually done intimidation for corporations, and they explained a few things. They said, well, A, they were probably tapping your place, so everything I say and do in here is listened to, if not watched. And then opening of the back window, because it's a much more private way to get in for future reference, for future visits. When I did return home, and the police came in and made sure nobody was here, and then I came in after the alarm was set off, after the break-in, and what I did notice was they had left this window unlocked, like this, and before I left for Sacramento, all of the windows and doors were locked, double locked, actually. I went through twice to make sure that they were locked. So after that happened, I didn't really feel comfortable sleeping in my house again, because of course they could come in and disarm my alarm whenever they wanted. There wasn't really another way to secure the system. I changed the code, but again, who knows how they got the code in the first place. The security expert is pretty convinced that the house is tapped, my phone is being listened to, my conversation, my text messages, and then my computer, both of my computers as well. The next thing that happened actually was with my computer. So one of the things that the police wanted to know was if anything was taken in the break-in. Of course, nothing was, because they weren't here to take anything. I did have a computer here in a hiding spot, and when the police were here, I did actually come and look to make sure the computer was still here, and it's here above the microwave is its hiding spot. It's not a place anyone would know to look for the computer, and it's not, you know, especially in being here in only 4 minutes. 2 days later, after that happened, after the break-in happened, I walked into my place to move some stuff out, and the computer was taken from its hiding place and put in the middle of the floor. And so I came back home to pick up some stuff. I wasn't staying here any longer. And that message was there, which was obviously very scary, because clearly somebody had been listening in, if not watching, as to where the computer was. So after that, I decided that it would be best to get out of town, and I left town for a couple of weeks and really went off the grid for a good part of that. So after the computer incident and leaving town for 2 weeks, the day that I came back, I had a friend come with me, and him and I arrived at my place and found a ladder open right in front of my door, looking into the windows, the bedroom window. Now, this is my ladder, but this ladder lives in the garage. So it was clear that somebody had accessed the garage, brought out the ladder through the side of my house, opened it, looking right up into the window, and this happens to be the only window that I had blinds open. So that was quite a message. The security experts said, wow, what a better message than to say we're watching you. And this actually happened the day that I came back into town, so they clearly knew that, it happened the night before. They clearly knew when I was coming back. The neighbor who was feeding my dogs came over after half an hour after we found the ladder, and she asked, so what's with the ladder? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I didn't put it there. And she said, well, it wasn't there yesterday. So it means that it happened the night before I came back into town after 2 weeks.
That's the voice of Brandy Vaughan there, from the grave, died in December. Martin, of course, you know, the circumstances around this, it is a very, very slim possibility that this is coincidence that she's died. But obviously she's being intimidated. She's being threatened. The police apparently are saying she was a founder and executive director of the group Learn the Risk about vaccines, died at the age of 45. So the police are saying that they believe it's a natural death. I would say it's very, very unlikely to be a natural death. But these sorts of tactics are interesting, aren't they? The idea that you come back and find things have been moved around, nothing's been stolen, a window is open, and this sort of thing. And then potentially on top of all that, we've got effectively here what could easily be a pharmaceutical industry death squad.
Well, I mean, I don't know the why she would have been targeted, but, you know, you've given some suggestions there. These kind of tactics are well known, and if people have seen the film Other People's Lives, it's about East Germany, and, of course, they're using fairly primitive technology, but this kind of gaslighting, if you like, letting people know that they're being watched. I mean, there are two ways of people watching you, in my experience. One is you don't know that they're watching you, because they just want to find out what's going on. And to my mind, I don't particularly mind if people just watch in that way. It's a sort of, you know, it's an occupational hazard for political activists. And the other one is where they intervene either to intimidate or frighten you, or alternatively, of course, to kill you. And, you know, people have got, I mean, we were talking earlier about the spy cops bill and what's been going on in this country for decades now. There is a police state. There's always been a police state, as I said earlier. It's not something that might happen. It's already there behind the scenes, and people are going to have to deal with it. And of course, the more information we get about how it operates, the more possibilities there are that we might be able to do something about it.
I mean, there's echoes here of 9/11 of Philip Marshall and what happened to him. He was a pilot who wrote a book called The Big Bamboozle about 9/11. He was in contact with Senator Bob Graham, sending early versions of a new book about 9/11 to him, when on the 2nd of February 2013 he was found shot dead along with his children and dog. So apparently the authorities concluded that he had killed his own children and his dog and then himself. The same sort of situation as we've got with Brandy Vaughan. Now, of course, the problem here is when someone that wants to murder somebody knows that they can pull weight to stop a police investigation, to stop a coroner's report. I mean, even here in Bristol, we had the whole situation with Paul Forrest, who was a very good coroner, being yanked from his job and a puppet coroner put in his place. And that isn't my word. That is the words of people who are working in the coroner's office, calling the new coroner a puppet coroner. That's what they called her. And so if we don't have an operating at a political level criminal justice system, and we don't have proper inquests going on, this is really like a green light for these sorts of political murders to take place. And we've just had, Martin, we were talking in the first part about the Covert Sources Intelligence Bill, which is apparently going to allow people who are agents of the state, police, etc., in the UK to kill people with impunity. So it does sound to me as if we're moving into a very dangerous area in the United States and the UK. Indeed, a totalitarian, authoritarian, fascist system.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, what I think is significant about these bills is that they've been pushed forward with a Tory government with its 80-seat majority, etc. And that's because of the, with the kind of technologies we've got now, we're able to investigate in real time things, for example, like the fact that the train the bombers took on 7/7 didn't run that day. And we established that. The police didn't establish it. We established it. And then they had to admit that the train that they said the bombers caught didn't run that day. Now, this means they've been doing this kind of thing for years. I mentioned the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972 earlier. Now, the thing is that they've realised that there is a potential for criminal prosecutions to come forward in the future. And this is why they're bringing these bills forward now, because they don't want, you know, basically they've been doing this stuff for years, and now they just want to be given a get out of jail free card to carry on doing it. But if you go, I mean, history is there. We know about Gladio. You see, there have been some prosecutions. Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wanted to prosecute people. He never got there in the end, but he wrote a book about it that came out in 2012. You've got people like Balthazar Garzon, who sent the Inigo, who was the Minister of the Interior, to prison as a terrorist because he was getting people assassinated in the Basque Country. I think that the enemy, if you like, are aware. They used to think that they could just get away with all of this stuff, but it's come to their attention that the possibility of criminal prosecutions is going to come up. And of course, there's no reason in my mind why you can't prosecute people for things that they did 50 years ago, if you've got enough evidence.
Well, there is
what these bills will do, which are being nodded through the Commons by the Tory majority and the hopeless spinelessness of Keir Starmer, is give them all a get out of jail free card.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the censorship, is we're doing it because we can, yeah? And this is a gangster attitude and mentality, a lawless attitude. The idea really here is that it's the Lords of Misrule, isn't it? In charge, just doing what they want without any recourse, without giving people recourse to the law. Of course, that was all begun by wonderful Ken Clark when he was Justice Secretary, taking away... for the vast majority of people who needed it, legal aid from the Tory government, when in the coalition government, I believe that was, back around about 2012, and stopping people squatting in residential properties, even if a place has been empty for 20 years. As soon as you step through the door, the landowner or anybody can just phone the police and the police will get you out for them. Whereas in the old days, of course, it was the landowner's job. If they weren't using a building and someone else was, that they had to take you to court and they could get you out within a few days or at the maximum a few weeks. Anyway, look, let's bring all this a little bit back to home and back to COVID a bit, because we're going to hear now from Artie Innes, technical problems all sorted out, it seems. Who I spoke to earlier this week. Now, he's a former millionaire, and he used to run a care home years ago up in Scotland. He then fell on hard times through relationship and divorce, and he ended up homeless on the streets of Bristol and in a homeless hostel. But he has been arrested a couple of times now here in Bristol for chalking slogans on the pavement, which I just find extraordinary. You should surely be able to, you know, write something in chalk. But of course, it's what he was writing, one of the things that he will tell us about, I'm sure. But I first asked Artie, who's living in a homeless hostel at the moment. I first asked Artie about what got him radical, enough to go out sort of chalking slogans on the street, even if the police are hanging around, he still gets on and does it. So where does his radicalism come from?
Generally, I'm not a particularly political person. I don't get involved with causes generally, but in recent times I found myself becoming increasingly sort of agitated and motivated by my conscience, I guess, to speak out. And I'm totally outside my comfort zone when I'm on the street with my megaphone speaking about COVID-19 and vaccines and how free speech has been reduced and increasingly taken away from us.
What was that moment that you realised, crikey, I'm going to have to do something here?
I guess about 5 or 6 months ago, it was something unrelated to COVID-19. Actually, I was living in a community here in Bristol called Emmaus, and I wore a T-shirt that said, "All Lives Matter." And I was told to stop wearing the T-shirt because it was offensive and bordering on the racist. And I totally disagreed with that. And because all my life I've fought for justice and equality. And, I strongly felt that saying all lives matter was much more unifying and likely to bring people together than the Black Lives Matter slogan.
So, well, hang on, but surely All Lives Matter is actually an anti-Black Lives Matter slogan.
I don't believe that at all. I believe that Black Lives Matter is actually an organisation which has been created to divide people. If you look at who funds Black Lives Matter, it's the elites of this world, and they're all about dividing us.
So what happened at the care home? Did you take off the T-shirt, throw it in the bin?
Well, to be honest with you, initially I took it off and I said, all right, I won't wear it because I didn't want to be homeless. But then I felt ashamed. I felt so ashamed. I said, I am going to wear the T-shirt. And when they saw me wearing it again, they evicted me. I was put on the street. I'm 55 years old. I was put on the street here in Bristol, where I lived on the street for 11 or 12 weeks. And then I got into selling the big issue.
So this was like June last year, so at least it wasn't too freezing cold.
I was actually given the eviction notice in the August, and I was evicted in the September.
Did you have any kind of appeal that because you've worn this particular T-shirt, that wasn't a reasonable excuse to throw you on the street?
No, because it was a community, and I'd signed some the contract of residence or whatever you call it. It said that they have the right to basically throw out anyone they want to for any reason. There is an appeal process, and but essentially, if they want you out, they'll put you out. So
you didn't bother with the appeal, thinking that really this is they'll be deciding this themselves. That sort of thing, is it?
I kind of appealed unofficially, but I was basically told there's no point in me appealing. So, and I didn't want to be somewhere where I wasn't wanted. So I left, and the council said I'd made myself intentionally homeless because I'd said I'd worn a T-shirt that was offensive. And, you know, I disagreed with that profoundly. And so I got virtually no help. I was left on the streets for 11 or 12 weeks. Now I'm in a hostel, and I'm quite happy at the moment. But while I was on the streets, I started selling the big issue, and it was while I was selling the big issue, I started to talk to people about what was happening in the world on the street. You know, big issue, so and so. You know, this is happening, and that's how it started. And that's then I went and got myself a megaphone so I could be heard, and then I started getting into trouble with the big issue.
Yes, got into trouble with the big issue. But anyway, so then I asked Artie Innes, we took an exclusive interview with Artie now, about the arrests, because he'd been chalking these anti-vaccine and anti-lockdown slogans, but he was arrested. So I thought I'd ask him about what happened there.
I was in Broadmead in Bristol, and I was chuckling on the ground, sort of anti-lockdown slogans and what have you, and the police came up to me after about 10 minutes. I think the super drug shop in Broadmead, who are actually administering the vaccines in the little porter cabin outside their shop, they didn't like the fact that I was quite close to their facility.
So when was this?
This was about 2 weeks ago, and the police came very...
So we're talking about sort of 20th of January-ish?
Maybe the 25th, something like that. And the police came very quickly, because, of course, it was a corporation that phoned them, so they come very quickly for the corporations. And they told me that basically I was causing criminal damage by chalking on the ground. And I said, no, that's not the case. Everyone's allowed to chalk on the ground. It's not a criminal, it's not an offence. If I was chalking something about climate change or something, or drawing rainbows or, you know, whatever, you wouldn't have an issue. No one would. It's because of what I'm chalking. That's what the issue is. And it's probably because I'm quite close to Superdrug and they don't like it. And they said, well, you know, you have to stop. You're not even exercising. And I said, well, I'm out enjoying the fresh air and walking around and kneeling down and drawing a few things and writing a few things. As far as I'm concerned, that is exercise. And I said, look, there's people sitting around eating their sandwiches on benches. I'm exercising more than they are. And they said, well, we don't accept that. We're cautioning you now. And if you don't leave, we're going to give you a fine. I said, well, I'm not leaving. I'm going to carry on doing what I'm doing. And they said, and they issued me with a fixed penalty fine. And that was the and then I still refused to leave. And they said, well, we're going to arrest you. And I says, well, do what you have to do, but I'm not going to stop doing what I'm doing because I feel really strongly that these things need to be talked about. So they arrested me. They took me in a car up to the top of Gloucester Road and then said, we're de-arresting you, you can get out. So I jumped out and I walked back into town. But basically, they were just trying to sort of get me away from the centre of town for a few hours. And I think they knew they were on a sticky wicket. But then, a week later, I was...
When you say the top of Gloucester Road, I mean, it's quite a long Gloucester Road. It's how far?
Up towards the prison. Horfield, yeah. But it was still a fair walk for me. And I was carrying all my placards and all my stuff, so it was a bit of a pain. But never mind. And then a week later, I was out walking, and every now and again, I'd bend down and write something about lockdowns and vaccines and what have you. But I was walking, but the police came up to me and they didn't even challenge me, they didn't even warn me, they just said, you're under arrest for criminal damage. They handcuffed me, took me to the police station in a police station van, I think they call it a sweat box, took me to Patchway, where they kept me for 7 hours, and then they dropped the criminal damage charge and gave me another fixed penalty fine for breach of COVID restrictions. So that was, in total, I've received three fines, totaling £600, and I've been arrested twice. I think it's an abuse of power, and it's about trying to control people and stopping the conversation.
Did you have any discussions with the officers as they're doing this? Because obviously, if they've just arrested you for something that they believe is a serious crime of some sort, then it's a bit peculiar that they're then just either de-arresting you or keeping you in for a few hours and arresting you with no charge.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange. I mean, the guys themselves, the police officers, you know, I've got, like I say, I've got friends who are police officers. I think most police officers are decent people. Essentially, unfortunately, they're mostly brainwashed. And they believe that they have to do as they're told. And they believe, basically, that the government have got a right to dictate what people are allowed to say and do, and you know, and that's the way that they're trained, and that's how they think.
Okay, so when you're chalking away, what kind of slogans are you chalking, and are you explaining to people who are reading that, you know, anything, or are you just saying something simple like lockdowns cause more deaths? Just take us through some of your slogans.
I've written things like, lockdowns kill. They're usually pretty short slogans, but sometimes I do write something that's much more, you know, it gives a lot more information. You know, sometimes I'll quote doctors, you know, like Dr. Michael Yeadan, who says the vaccination program is total madness. You know, I'm a quite spiritual person. Sometimes I actually speak in spiritual terms, and I sometimes call the vaccine Satan's jab, you know, and it gets people thinking, I guess. But I am a spiritual person, and some of my slogans are sort of leaning towards that kind of thing, you know.
Do you think that some of those things could be offensive to people?
Well, that's what I've been told. Some people are, and especially when I'm writing in centre of town, within sort of a short distance of the vaccination centre, or what I call the human experimentation facility. I wrote that as well, the human experimentation facility, with a big arrow pointing towards the super drug porta cabin where they're vaccinating people. And I did get challenged on that, and I was told that was offensive. And I also wrote something about Dr. Mengele, the angel of death. Come and meet Dr. Mengele, the angel of death, and point another arrow pointing towards the porta cabin. And I was told that was offensive. And perhaps it is. You know, I don't feel comfortable about upsetting people. You know, it's not my character, really, to upset people. But I do feel that this is such a sinister time in history. I believe the most momentous time in human history. And never before in human history have we faced being enslaved by technology. And the beginning of this enslavement is, as far as I'm concerned, is the vaccine. this nanotechnology vaccine, which is called a platform app, which they're going to build on top of. And they're going to turn us essentially into another species, and we're going to be a totally controlled species. And that's the way it appears to me.
Well, quite a disarming character, RT. Martin, there is something a little bit strange here, isn't there? The idea that it's criminal damage to chalk, for a start. And, I mean, we've been talking, probably for the last couple of years, about increasing limits on freedom of speech. What someone finds offensive really is what someone else finds normal. I just wonder what you make of RT and his arrests, particularly the fact that it seems that the police aren't actually interested in charging him with anything. They just want to get him out of the way. And this is something, of course, which is being done for the Broadmead Centre managers. You know, that it used to be, I think it was John Hurst. Nowadays, it's a guy called Steve Bluff is in charge of Broadmead, where all the shopping goes on and everything. And these are the people who are basically calling the shots.
Well, I think that's a good point, because, of course, if he's actually on private land, and, of course, a lot of these areas that used to be public spaces have been privatised, then they can say he's doing criminal damage to our property. Whereas if it was a public highway, that wouldn't be the case, would it? And it doesn't seem to me as if the police have got a very strong case against him because they haven't charged him with anything. And, you know, his views are not mine, but you know, that takes all sorts to make a world, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And my final clip from RT anyway is where he talks about what he thinks is the hidden agenda. He started to allude to it there, didn't he? But he thinks there's lots of hidden agendas going on. And I have to say, I think he's right, that there may be many hidden agendas because of the very, very blinkered coverage we're getting of this, basically propaganda coverage, where lots of particularly doctors' views being censored, not only by the mass media, by the mainstream press, those second opinions, but also by YouTube. You know, stuff disappearing within hours of being uploaded because it's a doctor's second opinion that Eric Schmidt at Google doesn't agree with. Anyway, let's have a listen to the final clip with Arty now.
They made life so difficult, particularly for the young, over the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, it's impossible for a young person today to feel that they've got a stake in society. It's virtually impossible for a young person to buy a home or to feel that they've got a stake in this society. And I think that's been done deliberately so that there will be an appetite for massive change. I also believe that there's a lot of lies in relation to climate change or man-made climate change. Climate has always changed throughout history, and I believe we're been told lies about man-made climate change in order, again, to justify the massive changes that they're going to impose on society. But, of course, everyone wants a cleaner planet and fairness as far as income is concerned. But if you're going to rip down the system, you want to replace it with something much better, not China on steroids.
Well, China on steroids is how RT is describing the Great Reset, and of course there is a bit of a danger of that. But Martin, this whole idea about the climate, which he's bringing in there, it may be very much of a dispute, but there's not a lot of dispute about the idea that young people have been deprived of a future. Certainly when, you know, you and I were given free educations back in the, whatever it was, 60s, well, 70s and 80s, with a full grant from the government. Nowadays, students being plunged into debt, and then even when they've gone through university, they've got a questionable level of education. So much of it is kind of, you know, corporate and vocational. There may not be a job at the end of it either.
Well, I mean, it's hard. You know, there's a lot of different ideas in there. I mean, basically, the real turning point was 1973, after they'd taken the dollar off gold. And a petrodollar system was created, which allows the US to basically run a military occupation of the planet paid for by everybody else. And, of course, they then privatized and broke up the welfare state that had been built up since the 1940s. And we've now got a situation where, you know, there's quite likely going to be a major crash despite all the money printing, and out of that will come war as it did in the 1930s. And of course, if you're living in certain parts of the world like Syria, the war started a decade ago, and it carries on day in, day out, funded by our taxes, folks. Although an interesting development this week is the suspension of arms sales to Saudi Arabia by Joe Biden. And of course, one of the things that Starmer could do is say, why aren't we suspending arms sales to Saudi Arabia, Prime Minister? Maybe you should put that down as a question next week.
I mean, are there ships, container ships full of missiles and bombs being used on the British Tornado jets that are raining down on innocent people in Yemen? Are they turning around in the ocean and heading back home to the US?
No, it's only a temporary suspension. So he's not saying we're going to cut you off. But they've realised that it's becoming an embarrassment. I mean, Saudi Arabia itself wants to get out of the war now. They invaded it. They thought they were going to overrun Yemen in 3 weeks because they've got so much more kit. And it turns out that they can't do it. And it's now, you know, they don't really know what to do about it.
Well, the Americans could maybe try the same tactic with the Israelis, put a bit of pressure on them, withhold some money.
Well, that's what they should be doing. I mean, this is the boycott disinvestment campaign in Israel. The B'Tselem, which is one of the oldest human rights groups in Israel, have said we've got to be absolutely clear about this. The modern Israeli state is instituting apartheid, and we call upon all people all over the world of goodwill to boycott Israel. Now, calls to boycott Israel are being accused of being anti-Semitic. And people are losing their jobs and stuff. And in the US, people who call for boycott and disinvestment can be sacked and so forth. But B'Tselem is a very well-established human rights group in Israel. Said no, this is apartheid, and therefore it's perfectly legitimate to boycott and disinvestment.
Yeah, probably the only thing.
As I said earlier, Israel is a welfare state funded by the US taxpayer.
And
if the US taxpayer decided not to fund them, they just have to shut up and put up.
How dare you say the Israeli state are apartheid? That's anti-Semitic.
Well, the B'Tselem are all Jewish Israelis, and as far as they're concerned, it is. And that's what they're saying.
Well, they're self-hating.
Jews don't agree.
They're self-hating Jews.
Sorry?
They're self-hating Jews.
Well, you know, you're using the language of the not to put too fine a point on it, fascist Israeli government. But I think, you know, I'm afraid, you see, all this rowing that Starmer has started in the Labour Party, the Israeli embassy that have pushed all of this, most people in Britain don't think too much about Israel-Palestine. It's not one of the things that they're mostly worried about. But if they want to have a row about it, and they clearly do, then we're going to have a row about it. And we're definitely not going to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy. But, of course, that's what may happen. And that will basically undermine the establishment state in this country, the Tory government. But it will also undermine the right wing of the Labour Party if they dare to go along with it.
Anyway, lovely to hear from Artie just then from the streets here in Bristol. Rare opportunity. But I think we'll be staying on the whole COVID business. We're going to go and have a listen to Dr. Rashid Buttar now. He's an American doctor, and he's looking at what he thinks is a kind of dictatorship of history. He thinks it will be all these things will be changing sooner than we think. But he's also, I think, takes quite a nice attitude, because as a doctor, he's looking at some of the hippie stuff here. You know, this is a lot of it is about feelings, and it's important that we're not feeling like we're in a cage. That's what we're going to be hearing about the cage a little bit later, actually, from Dave von Kleist. As he always says, think outside the cage. That's his little slogan. But anyway, so let's have a listen now to Dr. Rashid Buttar, looking at the kind of hippie stuff angle, the feel-good factor and the feelings side of the COVID lockdowns.
This isn't a thing about right and left. It has nothing to do with that. You know, that is a true statement. This is more to do with atrocities that are being committed, and the vast majority of the public does not know what's happening. They have no inclination to what the truth is. They have no awareness what the truth really is. These are parts of the narrative that the media has projected on us to let us go down a certain pathway, because remember, he who controls the narrative dictates history. So they're trying to control the narrative by allowing us to only hear what they want us to hear, so that history is recorded a certain way that they want it to be recorded. But the truth is different.
My point is very simple. I want you to become autonomous. I want you to have your autonomy. I want you to be empowered with knowledge, because once you're empowered with that knowledge, the one thing is that nobody can take advantage of you. Nobody can victimize you. Nobody can solicit you and take away from you that which is innate yours, which is your freedom, your rights, your own power, your own autonomy, your own ability. That will make life incredible. That will truly empower people to be able to be more autonomous than you thought was possible. There's always a silver lining. So just because you're experiencing a hardship, I want you to remember that it's not about the destination. It's about that journey. And remember that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. We're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings, okay? That the fact that we're spiritual beings having that human experience tells us that we're here for a purpose. We're here to learn something. And yes, we can get enamored with all the hardships that we're dealing with, or the nonsense, or the BS, or the garbage. But remember, there's something here that is helping us. It's helping our children. There's a purpose behind it. We may not be aware of the purpose. We may not be fully cognizant as to what that purpose is fully representing at this point, but we will be later. So hold steady and understand that whatever's happening, we're experiencing it for a greater purpose. And each one of you, every single person out there, the one person that stands up and says, no, I'm not going to participate in this stupidity, don't think that that's not significant, because you become a beacon for the other 100 people around you that are watching. Do not underestimate the power of your stance to stand strong and stand up and hold your head up. So my point is, never underestimate the lesson that you are imprinting on others. Never underestimate that you standing up, maybe you think you're alone, but there are people watching you, and your actions are inspiring them to take action. Your actions are inspiring the children, the next generation, of understanding what's happening. Even if you don't see anybody watching you, and even if nobody is watching you, you are still setting that example, that inspiration, because energetically you're leaving a signature of what you're doing, how you're doing it, why you're doing it. Don't underestimate that, okay? Many times people think, oh, well, I'm just one person. It doesn't matter. It matters. It matters for every single person. Every single one that's doing this, that's standing up, it matters. So don't underestimate that, guys. Well, not even for a moment. Your energy should not be plagued by fear in any way, fashion, or form. Don't allow fear to dictate your actions. Now, please don't misunderstand me. There's a very big difference between danger and fear. But there are many things that are dangerous. But when you allow fear to dictate your actions, that's when the problems arise. There's always danger, and to be cognizant of that danger and to maneuver around that danger, there's nothing wrong with that. But fear is something different, okay? Fear is the paralysis that you allow to sit in based upon your overactive imagination. Fear is actually being concerned about a potential future that has not occurred based upon your vivid imagination. It's actually what people allow their own imagination to empower, realizing that what they've created, this demon, this something that they're scared of, it's a creation of their own mind, of their own imagination. And it's just as easy to make the decision that, hey, I'm not going to be fearful. And in fact, I'm going to focus my intention on the opposite of fear. What is the opposite of fear? Opposite of fear, guys, is love, not courage. People sometimes say, no, Dr. Vitar, it's courage. No, the opposite of cowardness is courage. The opposite of fear is love. The antidote of fear is love. So stay focused on love. Where attention goes, energy flows. Remember that.
So that's Dr. Rashid Buttar there. Wikipedia, of course, lists him as a conspiracy theorist, American conspiracy theorist. He's from Charlotte, North Carolina. His book, Martin, is Nine Steps to Keep the Doctor Away. You know what? He's a kind of a Vernon Coleman in a way, is that he likes the idea that people wouldn't need doctors. Of course, the pharmaceutical industry model is that they will be permanently having to come back to buy more and more pills, or have them through the NHS or whatever. But anyway, what do you think it's valid for the medical doctors like him to start going on about this kind of hippie stuff, like talking about the energies? And I think what he's trying to do is kind of up people's morale a bit, and that often gets forgotten at the doctors.
Well, Ivan Illich, who was an ex-Catholic priest, wrote a book that came out in the early 60s called Medical Nemesis, and it was basically about the US healthcare system, inverted commas, and about how it was just driven by profit, how it basically was an illness system, not a wellness system, and so on. So in a sense, there's quite a wide consensus around this kind of thing. And of course, whatever else the recent crisis has shown is how inadequate the US healthcare system is in every possible way you could imagine. And of course, we all, you know, I mean, a lot of what he's saying there is, you know, there's nothing that I would argue with. But then on the other hand, there's not exactly a very scalpel-like analysis of the real threats that we're facing, whether it's nuclear weapons or financial collapse.
I think he's trying to cheer people up, saying, look, you know, don't feel like you're on your own, this sort of thing. And, of course, doctors quite often will prescribe you some happy pills rather than actually boost your morale and understand that that's what's needed. Anyway, so have a listen to Vernon Coleman now, but not as you've ever heard him before, I'd imagine. Because somebody the other day uploaded onto YouTube an interview with Vernon Coleman in 1981 on a regional ITV news channel called ATV Today. So he was up in Warwickshire. I guess this is in Central Television in Birmingham. Well, it's actually before Central Television was even created. This is the pre-Central TV, ATV, which was Anglia Television, which had the franchise for Birmingham for ITV in those days. So let's have a listen now to a minute or so of Dr. Vernon Coleman. And Martin, I mean, I know you're not a great fan of his, but here he is setting out the stall. Basically, what's going on is there's a news story about the Department for Health and Social Security demanding to see notes which are made by doctors if people have gone off sick from work. And Vernon Coleman is here sticking his neck out, rather, on the TV, saying, I'm not going to allow any of my confidential information between me and my patients to go to the DHSS, and he explains why. So let's have a listen to Dr. Vernon Coleman way back in July 1981 now.
If you're pregnant, or you've got venereal disease, or you've got asthma, or you're depressed, or you're suffering from anxiety, I think all these things and a lot of other things are problems which people would very much like to keep between themselves and their doctor. Being from depression, for example, and you work for a large company, you may find that your future role in that company is diminished because the bosses may feel that you're not suitable for promotion. So a simple word on a sick note can ruin a man's career.
Wouldn't it be simpler for you just to bow to the rules?
Well, there are lots of simpler ways of dealing with it, of course. I could just simply be slightly dishonest and write flu on all the sick notes. But it seems like a slightly easy way out.
Now, you say you're prepared to break the rules. This could cost you a £1,000 fine or even more. So how far are you prepared to go?
Yes, well, I suppose eventually they could stop me practicing within the health service. But I feel this is so important that it's a basic principle of medical practice, that confidentiality between patient and doctor is of vital importance, and the rules and regulations of the DHSS must come second to that. And if the rules say that I can't maintain confidentiality, then the rules will have to go, or I'll have to go.
35-year-old Dr. Vernon Coleman there, speaking on ATV Today in July 1981 from his practice in Warwickshire. I think it's Leamington Spa he's in at the time. But Martin, it's an interesting principle, that, isn't it? Way back, gosh, this is 40 years ago now, the government is trying to get our medical records off of doctors, and doctors are saying no, at least that particular doctor is saying no. We're in the situation now where, when this pandemic started, the medical authorities have handed over vast amounts, apparently, of our personal private medical data to effectively to data miners. And these can be, these information can then be sold to insurers and all sorts of people. So this is, he's obviously at the cutting edge there of this attempt to steal our personal private medical data.
Well, if you think it was in 1981, the Tories at that stage were pushing the idea that, you know, that doctors are signing people off sick, and they didn't want it. Although, of course, what subsequently happened after the miners' strike and so on, they were actually encouraging doctors to sign people off as sick because they didn't want to count them as unemployed. And, of course, lots of people are unemployed at the moment who are not in the unemployment figures because they're constantly manipulated. And, of course, what was even worse than that is the recent round of attacks on sick and disabled people was that people who weren't medical doctors were, you know, people had to go to these interviews with people who were untrained. And then if you couldn't walk, you know, they were signing people off as fit for work. And otherwise they would lose their benefits.
Yeah,
and
I remember talking to
a guy who'd just come from hospital, having had a cancer of the spine removed, and he was going to have another operation for the cancer of the spine, and he came into the pub I was in, and he said, and he was asking that, can I have some work? I've been told to go and look for work. And I was chatting to him, and he was saying, well, yes, I've just had a cancer removed from my spine. I've got another one to be removed, but they're saying I've got to go and find some work, and I'm trying to get a job as a barman. That's the kind of society that we've become. And of course, what should happen is only doctors, and only on a confidential basis, should decide who is and who is not sick. It's not the business of the government. It's not the business of ATOS. This isn't the Burma Railway. It's only doctors in confidence who, and if they sign somebody off as sick, that's it. It's not the government should just accept that. That's what's happening. Pay the money. That's what ought to happen. But of course, that's not what, because of austerity, because we had to bail the banks out, we've got to save money, apparently. Although we've now discovered that the magic money trees are full.
Yeah, Martin, the bigger picture here, though, is we're living in this kind of Big Brother state, aren't we, where vast amounts of our personal information are being hoovered up by these data mining firms and then sold on the open market, well, not on the open market, to financial companies. And it's this kind of religion of finance. It seems to be the only thing that matters anymore. We are being subjugated by this system, which including, you know, the idea that you've got your personal private data doesn't really seem to be there anymore. We've got to constantly fight to keep it, but the government is actually colluding with these banksters and these financial people to give them total information awareness about everything to do with us.
Yeah, and you know who's a big fan of all of this? Dominic Cummings. And I can't remember the name of the woman, but she was based in the US, and she convinced all of these companies that her system for, it was a computerized system for predicting people's illnesses, and it was a complete scam. And, you know, but there is real dangers of manipulation of medical data. That's why NHS, public medical data, should be kept confidentially by the NHS and it shouldn't be given to private data companies.
I'm afraid,
like Peter Thiel and so on.
But of course, Cummings
has been pushing
Martin,
this idea,
Martin,
and they've brought
this
loads
isn't
of
Dominic
people
Cummings
in,
that's done this
as a result of the crisis,
Martin,
to get access to people's
Martin,
data.
It's not Dominic Cummings that's done this, but the big data companies have taken a lot of our information. I'll dig that story out. Maybe we'll have a listen and mention it, the exactitudes of it, after we've heard the second clip from Vernon Coleman, which is a much more modern one, in his 70s or his 80s. I'm not quite sure how old he is now. And here he is this week talking about what he thinks is a big experiment promoted by celebrity war criminals. That's the way he describes the pandemic. Anyway, Vernon Coleman again now.
The enthusiastic celebrities are promoting an experimental vaccine, or an experimental whatever it is. The United States National Library of Medicine published details of the vaccine program currently underway, and they say that the trial will last 2 years. Anyone having the vaccine is therefore taking part in an experiment. David Lammy and the Archbishop of Canterbury want your granny to take part in an experiment, and your granddad, and you too. The Medicines Agency in the UK knows it's an experiment. They advertise for special software so that they can keep track of the high number of adverse events they were expecting. For 2 years. Of course, even after 2 years, we still won't know what's going to happen to people who have the vaccine, or what might happen to any children they might manage to have. It's all a mystery. Though we do know that there are very real risks of changes to the immune system of those having the vaccine. But it's okay, David Lammy and the Archbishop of Canterbury say it's okay. They read it somewhere, or someone told them, or they saw a government advertisement. I bet you a pound to a peanut that they didn't actually look through the scores and scores of scientific papers before coming to that conclusion. I bet they didn't make up their own minds before telling millions of people to take the bloody vaccine. They just repeated the garbage they were told, and that's garbage in, garbage out. The fact is that no one, not even David Lammy, can possibly know if the vaccine is safe and effective because the trial's still underway. You can look at the paper yourself. It's in the United States National Library of Medicine. Look for clinicaltrials.gov, and you'll see on page 3 of 14 that the trial or study is expected to be completed on the 31st of January 2023. Can you understand that, David? It's an experiment. It's not over yet. No one knows what's going to happen in 2 years. But vaccine-loving Bill Gates, whose foundation is making a fortune, let us not forget, wants 7 billion people to take part in the experiment.
So that's Vernon Coleman there, speaking about what he says is a massive experiment, Martin.
Yeah, but what I would pick up when he's talking about the vaccine, there isn't just one vaccine, is there? The Pfizer vaccine is a completely different technology from all the other vaccines. Incidentally, of course, it's the most expensive as well. So there's certainly an issue there. But of course, the question is, even if you're going to use vaccines, which vaccine are you going to use? And of course, they are experimental vaccines. There's no doubt about it. They've rushed all this stuff through because of the danger of the situation. But of course, in some countries, mostly in Southeast Asia, they can wait and see whether the vaccine works or not, because they've actually got COVID under control by using lockdowns, I'm afraid.
So let's have a listen now to, I suppose he's special guest of the week, really. And it's Dave Von Kleist. I first came across Dave. He had a regular radio program over in the United States on GCN, Genesis Communication Network, and back in the 1990s and noughties. And I just basically, the reason I particularly like Dave is because he produced a documentary that some of you might remember, which came out in 2004, called In Plain Sight. And it was the first film that really woke me up to the dangers of the September the 11th attacks being ignored. And I knew as a journalist I was going to have to get really engaged with 9/11 to find out what had really happened, because certain things we were not being told. And the evidence was clear in his film. Very important and interesting film, I thought. But Dave did it. He actually got his finger out and made the film and got it out there. So I also remember putting that online, and we were selling at the time DVDs online on the internet, the old Eye Contact video site. And then as I put that 9/11 in Plain Sight video on there that people could buy in PAL, you know, which is the UK format, literally the next day we were hacked, and loads of fake credit card details were put into the bank account, into the website, just after I put that up online. But it's a terrific film. If anyone has not seen, it's well worth it. But anyway, I thought I'd speak to Dave Von Kleist this week about what he thinks is going on really right now.
I can't say definitively what's going on. I can only try to think outside of the cage. And I say outside of the cage because a cage is a little bit more difficult to break out of than a common box. And unfortunately, the intellectual cage that most of us are living in is created by the subterfuge and the propaganda that's thrown at us 24/7 by the mainstream networks. So to think outside of the cage, I want to turn the clock back a couple of years. Now, we know that once Trump was elected, and he started traveling around the country, he went to Saudi Arabia, he went to Israel, he went to the Vatican, he went to Brussels, and basically read all these people the Riot Act when it comes to sex trafficking, children, okay? This is a huge, huge issue. This is probably one of the biggest issues that humanity is facing right now, because this leads to all the others. But the bottom line here is that first, we have Harvey Weinstein from Hollywood. He gets busted. And then we have Jeffrey Epstein, and he gets busted. Now, we already know that this is an unspoken horror that is a global catastrophe. It is a global crime against humanity. And that these monsters were being exposed. And not only that, their power structure was being challenged. So take the clock back a couple of 2 years ago. You remember all the yellow vest protests that were going on all over Europe, France, Germany, Spain, Italy. Now, wait a second. How do world leaders feel when all these people get out in the streets? Does it make them feel too secure? Okay. So what would be a good way to clear out the streets? Oh, and by the way, let's not forget in Hong Kong, they were protesting by the millions in Hong Kong. So how would these world leaders all work to get these people off the streets? Well, how convenient. How about a pandemic? Okay. I'm not saying that this was purposely released. I'm suggesting it. I'm not going to say definitively that that's what happened. But you have to always ask the question, who benefits? Who benefits from the release of COVID-19? Well, it's not hard to figure out. We're witnessing the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of the world right now. Not only that, but we are also witnessing the suppression of rights of people all over the world. We're being socially conditioned not to speak to one another. Cover your face. Keep yourself social distance. Stay at home. You know, this is social engineering. And so, yeah, I have to ask the question, who benefits from this whole COVID-19 thing? And I don't think it's too hard to figure out.
Do you, Martin?
Well, you know, on this show over many weeks, I've given my copper's hunch about what happened here. And, of course, there are no lockdowns going on in most of China.
Just answer the question.
And the question is, what's going on here?
Who benefits?
Oh, well, who benefits? It's the banksters who crashed the economy and have now been bailed out yet again. And of course, what they hoped to do was trash the Chinese economy as the centerpiece of what they'd done. But I think that the Chinese have worked out what was going on, and they're in a strong position now. And it's the Western elites who want their great reset who are going to actually find that they've thrown the dice and it's come up snake eyes. So we're going to see what's happening. There's going to be a massive geopolitical change. That's what's going to happen. Okay. Southeast Asia is now growing. Its economy is growing because they've not got lockdowns. They are now in a position to seize the commanding heights of the world economy.
Anyway, let's have a listen to the second clip from Dave von Kleist now, as he talks about one of the big lies, which is that the fact that there are chief potential life-saving drugs which have been completely bypassed because Big Pharma wants to sell their big expensive vaccines to the world.
Hydroxychloroquine has been out there for 80 years. It's been used all over the world. I mean, it's sold over the counter in many different countries. I mean, people take those like aspirin in certain parts of the world with no problem. And now all of a sudden, oh my God, hydroxychloroquine is dangerous. Anybody who talks about it is dangerous. We have to censor anybody who even says hydroxychloroquine. Get them off of Facebook. Take their Twitter account down. Why would they do that? Who benefits? Again, these treatments and maybe even cures are a direct threat to their agenda.
But Bill Gates actually comes across as quite an affable chap, doesn't he?
Yes, you know, and radiator fluid has a sweet smell and a pretty color too, but if you drink it, you die. Okay? You can sugarcoat anything that you want, but it's the function of what it is that they're selling, which is the important thing that we watch. So what is it Bill Gates was saying? He was on MSNBC about a year or so ago, and he was talking about his $10 billion. What was it, 10 million or 10 billion? I don't know. It doesn't make any difference. The bottom line is he said he's putting in $10 million expecting to get $200 million back. You know, I mean, it's an investment. It's money. You know, that is what drives these people. They don't care about humanity. Are you kidding me? If the government or these monsters actually cared about humanity, they would have gone after Monsanto 30 or 40 years ago. They would have gone after all the companies that are throwing additives in our food and putting prions in our plastics and bisphenol A in our foods that's altering our hormones. You know, if they cared about humanity, they would have been cleaning this stuff up a long time ago. So now they come out with a vaccine, say, hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you and save your life. Bull crap. Sorry. You had your chance to gain my trust. And once you lose trust, you never get it back again. So anybody wants to, you know, government agency that wants you to stick your arm out because they want to help you, for what? To not have me catch this virus? And we already know the mortality rate is the same as a bad flu bug. I mean, the question is, okay, you're over there in the UK. How many people have died from influenza this year? How many people have died from heart attacks? What I'm saying is that you, if you have the flu bug or you go in with a heart attack and you pass away and they test you for COVID-19 and it's positive, then guess what? It's a COVID-19 death. There's a difference between dying from COVID-19 or dying of or with COVID-19. I mean, we all have coronaviruses. You know, if you've ever had the flu, you've got a coronavirus in your system. And they've been saying, and they've come out now, the CDC's had to come out and admit that these tests can be up to 97% false positive. It's working to their benefit. Oh, you got COVID-19. Oh, then you got to have a vaccine. You know, it's the cards are stacked in this game. They really are. I have to say, okay, if you look at how many people usually die, I mean, I looked it up a couple of days ago. It's usually 400-something thousand people die each year from influenza. And this year it's like 987. So what happened to all those people who died from the flu?
Good question. Final clip. By the way, the longer interview with Dave von Kleist I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And I will do the same with the 45-minute interview with R.T. Innes as well, as he describes a lot about his trials and tribulations over the last few months as he's been made homeless. They told him he's intentionally homeless because he wants to wear a T-shirt which says All Lives Matter, which some body has decided is racist or offensive. And they'll be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later tonight. But the final clip with Dave von Kleist is his big theme in all of this. And in fact, when we were talking to him years ago, Martin, about the 9/11 attacks, is you've always got to look at who benefits. So let's see who he thinks benefits now.
Do you trust the government and the media? Yes or no? So most people, you ask the question, do you trust the government? Do you trust the media? It's usually no, I don't, and no, I don't. So the next question, where do you get most of your official information? From the media or the government, right? Now, how does that make sense? It's garbage in, garbage out. People who are raised and weaned on a steady diet of misinformation, disinformation, and lies are going to find that the truth tastes funny when you try to eat it. Okay, the powers that be do not want truth out there. They lie. And so, you know, like you said, if your opinions are built from misinformation, disinformation, and lies, then that means your opinion is an extension of the lie. We're being gaslighted. We're being lied to. We're being manipulated, socially engineered. Whatever term that you want to put on it, it's garbage in, garbage out. So if you want to know what to do, I say take off your masks. Go out, have fun, open the restaurants, hang out, go play in the mud, get dirty. That's how you build your immune system. You know, by putting on masks and frantically hand washing, your body needs to stay in good health. And it's sort of like your immune system needs exercise. If you start eliminating anything that might make you a little bit infected or a little bit sick or something like that, if there's nothing there for your immune system to work on, eventually it atrophies. You end up hurting your immune system. You need to be exposed to stuff every day. So yeah, throw the mask away. Go to the pub. Tip a couple pints. Give somebody a hug. You know, grab that girl next to you and give her a kiss. You know, just be human. This is what they're doing. They're taking away your humanity. The psychology of covering up your face. I mean, my gosh, that not only muzzles you, but it takes away your ability to express. You know, when you look at somebody and they raise their eyebrows, or they squint, or they smile, or their jaw drops. These are all facial expressions that are being stolen from you. This is your humanity that's being taken from you. This is why they're doing it. Getting everybody scared to death and staying at home and not afraid to interact with everybody. Who benefits? You must ask that question to everything that's going on right now. And listen to your heart. Your heart won't lie to you. But you know what? These SOBs on television are lying to you 24/7. They have their agenda. They don't care about you. They want money and they want control. And there's just too many awake people out there. Let's get rid of a whole bunch of them. Let's get rid of some, you know, the elderly, because they're taxing the system. You know, I mean, again, think outside the cage, folks. Just put the puzzle pieces together. And sometimes this is sort of like a big jigsaw puzzle, but you don't get to look at the box. You don't know what the picture is. So you look at each one of these issues and you study them. And one by one, the puzzle pieces will start to fit together. And when you start to see the big picture, that's when things get really interesting and, yeah, pretty scary. But you can't fight an enemy that you can't see. So you have to look at these puzzle pieces. You have to ask the tough questions. And above all, ask who benefits.
Dave von Kleist there with his view on the whole COVID pandemic and giving some advice about ways to, I suppose, up your morale and ways to cope with it if you're feeling depressed about everything. And also making the usual points about the mass media really being there for mind control purposes rather than news. And I was certainly, as a journalist that worked for the BBC in the 1980s and 90s, say that the standard of journalism now is absolutely appalling. And I know journalists personally who simply have to pay the mortgage and they hate a lot of the stuff that they're doing and they need a lot of relief valves in the background basically because of they don't believe a lot of the things that are going on. We had a discussion in the union this week, a brief discussion about Google, who are paying the Press Association vast amounts of money to get rid of journalists completely and have automatically AI generated articles. So this is the way things are going. Journalism is the idea, I think, eventually is to just completely sack all the journalists and get rid of them. I suppose that part of that is putting people from Antiques Roadshow on the BBC to run their main weekly political program. But Martin, look, just one of the things that he brought up during that, and like I say, the full interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, is the Jeffrey Epstein case. We've still got Ghislaine Maxwell chugging along in the background and her court case. She's been in jail, but she's doing everything she can to get out. She's appealing against her bail, and she's also, her lawyers are arguing that she had nothing to do with it at all. And that the only reason that she's been arrested is because Jeffrey Epstein died.
Well, I mean, it sounded to me as if he was buying into the QAnon conspiracy theory, whatever you want to call it, about sexual trafficking. The Epstein case, to my mind, is quite clear. This is Mossad using honey traps to blackmail Western politicians. And that was a long rant and all the rest of it, but I didn't hear any analysis of which intelligence services are involved. What are the geopolitics of this? It's just that everybody on the TV is lying to you. What, everybody on the TV? I was on the TV yesterday. Was I lying to them, or was I telling them what
you
I thought?
You weren't on the BBC, Martin, were you?
No, I wasn't on the BBC. But in other words, there's not enough detailed analysis. If we're going to talk about the Epstein case, we need to talk about Mossad, don't we? That's what we need to talk about. Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, worked for the Israeli intelligence services. It's possible that they assassinated him. These are the kinds of nitty-gritty details which I'm not hearing. It's just a great big, oh, they're all trying to, it's all this and that and the other. There's no analysis. There's no mill and tell analysis there. It's just a lot of, and we've got to listen to our hearts. What about, I'm not against listening to your hearts, but you also need a bit of hard-headed intellectual analysis to understand who's, when he's saying who's benefiting, he didn't actually come out with him. He didn't say who was benefiting. I didn't hear the word Mossad, Israel, bankers, nothing. It's just somebody doing something to us. The question is who? And that means, you know, you've got to have people like Imposimato who's going to investigate.
Yes, names and addresses. These people do have names and addresses, don't they?
That's right, because all stuff is ultimately enacted by real people in real time, in real spaces. And that's why it's not just a general thing. It's all, everything is about the detail, isn't it?
Okay, well, as we wind down now, we're going to hear a clip. And thank you for pointing this out to me, Martin, about the death of poor old Sir Brian Urquhart. He was living over in the United States. I suppose they want to keep him there to keep an eye on him. He was a Deputy Director General of the United Nations. He was also the young intelligence officer at Operation Market Garden during the planning of that. That was basically banging his fist on the table and saying, if you send these guys into where these tanks from the SS Panzer divisions, the 9th and 10th SS Panzer divisions are hanging around, they're going to get slaughtered. And of course they did. But he was sacked by Frederick Browning, Boy Browning, for his pleasure. And Browning, though, did take a bit of his advice, because he didn't land Martin, did he, with the main force, as a general, a field officer should do. You would have expected that the leader of that operation would have landed with the 1st Airborne Division, but Browning didn't. He landed with his chefs and a massive load of headquarters and cooks and things like this back in Nijmegen, where he knew it was safe. And one does wonder whether he did that just because of what he'd heard from Sir Brian Urquhart, but he actually sent his 1st Airborne Division, the British 1st Airborne Division, into the jaws of death knowingly, actually.
Those responsible for the decisions were not willing to face the implications of the intelligence that we gave them. In my case, I strongly disagreed on matters like the drop zones being far too far from the bridge, the importance of the 9th and 10th SS Panzer Divisions, and the Royal Air Force's insistence in only having one sortie on D-Day, on the first day of the operation. I thought that the idea that the Germans were not strong enough to oppose Market Garden was dangerous nonsense. I believe that the plan, therefore, required serious high-level reassessment in view of the latest developments. I was dismissed by General Browning on the 15th of September, 2 days before the operation began, apparently for nervous strain.
When and where did you return onto the battlefield?
I was ordered to resume my post in the headquarters of the Airborne Corps in Nijmegen on the 23rd of September. I thought that General Sosabowski was a very fine fighting soldier who was confronted suddenly with an unusual and unforeseen danger, which he handled with skill and great courage.
Could you please tell us what were the most important lessons learned from the Operation Market Garden?
I think the most important lesson is probably the oldest one. Commanders must always be frank and honest, especially with themselves. Those with important direct responsibilities should not be saddled by more senior commanders with orders which they believe to be fundamentally unsound. I did not know of the details of General Sosabowski's treatment by Browning and Montgomery and the War Office until much later, when I was about to go on the annual pilgrimage to Arnhem in 2006. I made a broadcast on this subject on Netherlands Radio on my way to Arnhem because I was indignant that such charges could stand unchallenged by history, and I felt that something must be done to right the wrong that had been done to a courageous man and a fine soldier. I regret that so far the British government has not followed the example of the Dutch government in recognizing the service and sacrifice of General Sosabowski and his brigade at Arnhem.
So that's Sir Brian Urquhart there. It's a bit bizarre because there was another Urquhart who was a general of the 1st Airborne Division who did fly in, actually got isolated and lost his division because he couldn't get back to them. But Martin, the background to this is pretty shocking, isn't it? And I don't think Sir Brian Urquhart, possibly to his dying day, ever realised that there were deals going on, weren't there, behind the scenes, particularly between Winston Churchill's private secretary Desmond Morton and Adolf Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann. A lot of that stuff had kind of had been going on for a while, but it really started kicking off after the August 1944 Red House meeting, once it was clear that the Allies had a very successful D-Day, they weren't going to be thrown back in the Channel, that the war was over effectively, you know, in all but name. These deals were being done and they were preparing for a unification of the Germans with the Allies in order to take on the Russians, and they were hoping that the Russians were going to, many Russians as possible, were going to die on the way to Berlin to soften them up. So there's quite a lot going on in the background here, but key thing really is that this battle took place at Arnhem, just down the road is Oosterbeek, which is one of the key places in that battle, which was a pocket of British soldiers were surrounded, the Witch's Cauldron, which is the same spot exactly where the Bilderberg Hotel is, where the Bilderberg Conferences began in 1954. And one of the monies that dropped for me after discussing all this and doing some joint research with Dave Barmby was very important, really, that this is what it was, an in-joke, basically, that Bilderberg was an in-joke, that they knew, nobody else knew, was that the British and the Germans at that point were cooperating and that they wanted to sacrifice these soldiers in order to extend the war for several months and allow the Nazis to squirrel their wealth away to be used by the mafia and various other people after the war. Now, that might sound far-fetched, but it was quite clear that the troops could have made it to Arnhem. It's just that it came down through the chain of command, Peter Carrington, we mentioned earlier, and that later to be NATO chairman or secretary general, and others, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands involved as well as an intelligence officer, even though he was a former SS officer, being let in on it, Brian Horrocks, the commander of the 30 Corps, right up through the command structure, they simply halted. When they got across the bridge at Nijmegen, they waited until the last British had been bumped off by the Nazis at the bridge or surrendered, as Tony Hibbert was. He was the brigade major at the bridge at Arnhem. And so it's a quite significant battle, Martin. And I think for many years, for me and others, it's been a conundrum as to why it was such a disaster. Now I think we know, and in fact even one of the writers on the subject, he said he never goes to the anniversaries in Arnhem for two reasons. One is that they're like a kind of party, which seems bizarre for a Nazi victory, but secondly because the whole thing was so political.
Well, I mean, you've given a very brief summary there of the allegations, which are obviously in your book The Traitors of Arnhem, and I think we can't really do justice to all the detail at the end of a very long show. But yes, there's an awful lot there that people need to understand. And the most important takeaway, of course, is that elements within the Nazi state, in particularly the secret state, were absorbed into NATO from the very beginning. So pretty obvious thing to point out is that Reinhard Gehlen, the former head of the Gestapo, ends up as the head of the West German intelligence services. And if people can't see what's wrong with that, then they really need to take their masks off. Literally, not literally, but figuratively.
Okay. So before we have a last, I mean, the 82nd Airborne Division was the division that landed by parachute in Market Garden in Nijmegen. And one of the things I do in the book is go into some of the units involved in this, the 1st Airborne Division, the 82nd and the 101st American Airborne Divisions. And where are they now? Sort of, you know, what are they up to these days? And I think there's something from 30 Corps as well, or one of the units involved in that. And it's interesting to see that they're now involved in all sorts of covert operations, political assassinations and this sort of thing. And one of them is a chap from the 82nd Airborne Division who served in Korea by the name of James Files. He then became, he's actually still alive, he's in jail in the United States. And he then became, as he when he came out of the army, having had to survive firefights in Korea, he was recruited by the Chicago mob and became one of their hitmen. In fact, he had a great list of all the various hits that he'd done that he hid away, and he managed to survive being tortured by what he thought was the FBI in order to get the information out of him about all these killings. And they left him his body thinking he was dead, but he wasn't. He was just unconscious. But anyhow, James Files went down to the JFK assassination the Saturday. He arrived in Dallas, actually in Mesquite, which is just east of Dallas. But he'd also got to know a guy called David Attlee Phillips through the Bay of Pigs, where a lot of people had been trained up to invade Cuba, and then President Kennedy decided to not give them sea and air support that they wanted. And that many of them went in there and the whole thing was a disaster and many of them got killed. So there was an enormous amount of resentment against Kennedy saying, well, you basically slaughtered the people that we trained. And one of the people doing the training was James Files. Now, there's an enormous, great long, nearly 2¾ hours interview with James Files, which details the whole thing, but we're not going to hear all that, don't worry. This is about 4 minutes where he talks about all of his links with David Attlee Phillips, who was his CIA controller. These are the people from the CIA that actually managed the various agents, of which James Files, who fired the fatal shot from the grassy knoll behind the picket fence that killed President John F. Kennedy in 1963. So let's have a listen now to James Files, ex-82nd Airborne Division, talking about the links, his links, particularly with David Attlee Phillips, his CIA controller, and how he knows that it was David Attlee Phillips that introduced him to Lee Harvey Oswald, who was down in Dallas at the same time and also was controlled by David Attlee Phillips. So it really was a CIA operation, quite clearly. And this, and he explains now, in his own words, James Files, how it worked.
I met Lee Harvey Oswald through David Attlee Phillips. When I got down there, he introduced me to Lee.
Was it your understanding that Phillips was also Oswald's CIA contact?
I learned that when I was down there. That is the first time he introduced me to Lee Harvey Oswald, and he also instructed me that Lee could be trusted and that he was Lee's controller.
He made that as a statement.
He made it as a statement because I wanted to know who he was dealing with and who I was giving weapons to.
I need you to make a statement that I was introduced by Phillips, who was my CIA handler, and I was told that he was Oswald.
We didn't call them handlers back then. We called them controllers.
Okay.
David Attlee Phillips, he introduced me to Lee Harvey Oswald. And upon doing this, he also explained to me that he was Lee Harvey Oswald's controller, the same as he was mine, that he was always in contact with Lee Harvey Oswald.
So that's how you know that's where the word came for Oswald to come meet you in Dallas.
So that, through common sense, tells me the only one that could have sent Lee Harvey Oswald to me was David Attlee Phillips. And when I opened the door and Oswald was there, I was kind of shocked to see him because I didn't know that he knew I was there. And so I asked Lee, I says, what the hell are you doing here? Because I was shocked, you know. I said, I was advised to drop by and spend some time with you and see if I could help you out. I said, help me out? He said, yes. He says, somebody wants me to show you the area. And I said, okay. I said, come on in. So he come on in. So we sit down and we talked. And I said, I'll be with you in a few minutes. And I was young and cocky at that time. And I'd just come out of the shower and everything. And I was combing my hair. So I had a camera there. So I told Lee, he said, hey, make a couple of pictures while I'm here in Texas. And so Oswald made a couple of pictures of me, and then he said, let me have the film. I get it developed. I said, no. I said, I get the whole roll of film. So that was how I got a couple of pictures made that people have recently asked me about.
But, whose camera was it, yours or
my
yours?
Camera.
Your camera.
Yeah. But he was going to take the film, turn him in, get it developed. But I said, no.
Didn't want to let that film go.
I do my own work.
How did he arrive at the motel?
He arrived driving a Blue Falcon, Ford Falcon.
You remember what year model?
No, I don't. It wasn't a brand. It was a couple of years old.
So he could drive?
Yes, he could drive. When he met me in Clinton, Louisiana, he drove up in a, I want to say Chevrolet truck. It could have been a Ford. I'm going to say pickup. It was a pickup truck. Let me put it that way. It was an old pickup truck. And we put the weapons in the back end of it and pulled the tarp down over the weapons.
What color? Do you remember what color pickup?
I believe it was green. It was a real, I don't know, dirty, yucky green, whatever you want to call it. Darker green, like, you know. It hadn't been washed in a long time, and there's a lot of rust on it. That's about the best way to describe it.
So did you and Lee Oswald drive around Dallas then?
We drove around Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald and I, we drove around Dallas for 5 days up till right before the assassination. I did not see Lee Harvey Oswald on the morning of the assassination. But prior to that, Lee Harvey Oswald had been with me every day. We drove around. He showed me different streets, different areas. He was the one that took me out to the place southeast of Mesquite there, next to a big junkyard. We went out there in the field. He said, ain't nobody going to bother you out here, you know, because I wanted to calibrate the scopes for the, not only for the fireball, but for other weapons as well. And while I was out there firing weapons and ejecting shell casings, Lee was picking them up and holding them in his hand. But I didn't want to leave no casings or nothing behind, and I'm busy firing, so I just looked at Lee, grab them casings. And that's what he did. He picked them and he held on to them until we got released. I calibrated my scope, set things up, put the stuff back in the car, and we got back in. We went riding around, and I wanted to know the railroad crossings. I wanted to wait and see what time trains come through. I want to know if there's any passengers, if there was freight trains. They stopped. The track's going to be blocked. The intersection's going to be blocked. Dead-end streets, construction work, where every intersection was at. Where all the lights were at, how long the lights were, they stayed red. I wanted all these little details.
So that's the voice of James Phillip, James Files there. Interesting, I think, the talks there about Lee Harvey Oswald picking up these cartridges that they've been doing test firing out in Mesquite. And that, of course, is why when the police got him, they found they suspected that it was him that had done the assassination, because they did tests on his hands and found that there was traces of cordite on the hands. So anyway, fascinating interview. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, what's been the effect, just briefly, obviously, of the Kennedy assassination today, because it was quite a big turning point in US history, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, last year during the early lockdown, Bob Dylan actually released a single called Murder Most Foul, which is about the Kennedy assassination. I mean, any competent person who looks into it knows that the US security forces carried out the Kennedy assassination, just as the FBI murdered Martin Luther King, because there was a court case in Tennessee, a civil court case, where a jury concluded that the state had carried out the assassination, even though there's a Martin Luther King Day in the United States. But it's amazingly enough, the Black Lives Matter demonstrators all talking about Martin Luther King, it's absolutely beyond dispute that the state killed Martin Luther King, but nobody has been prosecuted. Just as the British military working through the Loyalists bombed Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, but nobody has been prosecuted. Ultimately, this is what they call in Latin America impunidad, impunity. And we're going to have to put these people in prison, or the world is going to be pushed over the edge. We could go on, but it's like, you know, what, there's so much more that you can, everything's connected to everything else. And it's all about detail, 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 not just general statements about things.
Okay, well, R.T. Innes and Dave Von Kleist, the longer versions of those interviews will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour and the second hour. As ever, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, you just heard there. Thanks also to studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. But don't try and join the Google email list. You have to email me at tony@cultureshock.org.uk. That email also you'll find at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Also, have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.